Hello and welcome to Lot Awful Movies 31. How's it going, Andrew?
I usually say fantastic when we're taping the show, and that's usually true. I'm always excited to do the show. And then I usually say something when we're recording Lot Awful Movies because it ranges from good to jury duty. I am legitimately fantastic after having watched
Same
this movie twice.
Here. I am so glad to hear you say that. I'm pretty sure this movie was actually made for Lot Awful Movies. Only reason it exists. It's perfect. Yeah. I love it. I've never been so excited that I can remember for a Lot Awful Movies. Because it's hard to put into words, but like it was pleasurable to watch because it's Cher. It's 1987. It's Liam Neeson beating the tar out of people for no reason. It's Frasier's dad. It's Fat Tony. It's everything. It's everything we could want. And also, like, it's got a whole bunch of bad law. But also, okay, here's my thesis. And feel free to tell me I'm the dumbest idiot in the world. I don't care. Here's my theory on this. First off, this is just premise one. There is, like, more law in this movie than maybe any movie we've done. Like, it's nonstop courtroom or discussion about law and law, different law things, the judge, the voir dire, the everything. There's so much law in it. Now, here's point two. Now, this is where you may tell me I'm dumb.
Okay.
While there's a lot that obviously goes awry, law-wise, it loses it. And in fact, the third act of this movie just absolutely loses its fucking mind. It sets up pretty good and then just loses it. But, like, here's my theory. If this were not the SAT, so if this were a guesses don't count as negative, if this were you just get points for good law and no minus points for bad law, there's so much law in it and there's so much accurate representation of law just per minute. Like there's just so much that if it was a purely point scoring thing and you don't lose any points for getting stuff wrong, this might be a front runner. What do you think? That's my bold claim. What do you think?
The way in which you have described it, absolutely 100% correct. Yes. You are.
Awesome.
I think both premises are dead on. So we have tantalized the audience. We watched Suspect, the 1987 movie, which, by the way, like the top five billed actors in this are five amazing actors. Yeah.
Tour de force.
The cast is great. The horrible parts of this movie could be fixed, right? Like when we do our, like, how would we fix this at the end? Like I thought about this, like this could have been a great movie.
I agree.
Right? This could have legitimately been amazing.
It was like they did. Well, I don't know if we should do spoilers or what. I love, first off, you're right. The name's in the title of the show. So yeah, sorry, I didn't say it, but yeah, Suspect. And then you realize, like, why is it called Suspect? After I've watched this two times all the way through, it made less sense the second time. I was like, this movie makes no fucking sense. They start off so well. All right. Maybe we should get into it, but I'm so glad you've I also would say this third premise, maybe the funniest law joke of anything that I've ever heard. And I wonder if you know what I'm talking about.
I think I know, but we will find out. Can I also add, I hadn't realized until going back and watching this, because, you know, like my all time favorite movies that are from the '80s, like, are just sort of timeless. Mm-hmm. But like watching this '80s political drama thriller period piece,
so great.
Like I love the fact that atmospherically it's 1987 because that's where my head is, right?
Yeah,
like you've got the inadvertent brand placement, and every time, like, you know,
you'd scroll past the
Amoco station where gas is 84.9 cents a gallon. I was like, oh man, that reminds me of my senior year of high school.
That
was so great.
I know that I've reached the point in my life, like through the 90s, you know, obviously I'm a little bit different age than you, but through the 90s, everybody hated the 80s. It was like, oh my God, can you believe what the fuck they were doing with their hair and everything? Like, what a piece of shit decade that was. I know, it was horrible for you, I'm sure. As a kid, I don't know, maybe it wasn't in your generation, but as a kid, everybody was like, the 80s were the dumbest thing. Everybody collectively lost their minds. I've gotten to the point now where I see this, the shitty-ass police cars, you know, that are the...
the shitbox Dodge. Yeah,
and all that stuff, all the technology, the hair, the clothes, and I'm just like... I love this. I just want to live in this for no reason. Even though I was one, I don't really remember it, but like enough media, you know, when I was growing up that I saw kind of was this atmosphere. But we should.
Well, the same thing happened. The same thing happened when I was growing up to the 70s, right? Like it was.
Except the difference is the 70s did fucking suck, and I still hate the 70s.
You know, I mean, we could have a discussion about disco, but anyway. Nah. All right, let's get into. Would you like to rant about Sony fucking Crackle for a minute?
I'll tell the story of this. Being a resourceful, co-host, I got out ahead of this and I was looking for where we could watch this thing, and I saw it said free on Sony Crackle, and I said, "What the fuck is Sony Crackle?" But because I've recently gotten a new TV and new TV technology is great. I looked on, like, I've gotten to the level of new TV where there's an app store, and I go on my TV it's there. And I'm like, oh, I can install this Sony, whatever the fuck it is, app and watch Suspect from 1987 with Cher and Dennis Quaid for free with ads. So I think that's worth it. I get through, I think, 2 ad breaks, and I was like, fuck this, I am buying this movie. Because here's the thing about this. We have to watch these things at least 2 times. You know, I've done a few of them 3 times, but at least 2 times. And this, I don't know why, but some movies you can just rent on Amazon for $3.99, $2.99, whatever it is. I figure the demand for this movie can't be much, you know? Like, I don't hear a lot of people clamoring to like, oh, I'm going to get that one on DVD or whatever. But for some reason, it's not available for rent, at least on my Amazon that I saw. So
no, me neither. Yeah.
So it was either buy it for $12.99 and forever own the movie Suspect from 1987 with Cher and Dennis Quaid, or watch it on this Crackle. But the commercial breaks were so fucking god awful, and I was staring down the barrel of 2 2-hour viewings plus 1,000 commercials. I was like, I'm buying it. It's worth it to me. My time is worth $12.99. So I'm now the proud owner of Suspect from 1987 with Sharon Dennis Quaid.
Having been warned about that, I figured, I'll give Sony Crackle a try and see if I can stomach the ad breaks. I tried on 3 separate occasions to watch this movie on Sony Crackle, and it just put the like stupid little box on my screen, and it played the audio, but not the video.
Oh, do you have
video.
An ad blocker?
So, it was an ad block. And
I had ad block on, and I had to turn that off for it to even work at first. So it could have been that.
Yeah, yeah. So I was like, I'm not gonna fuck with my settings and also watch commercials. So I took out a Vudu account. I've never heard of this service before. Vudu, apparently they're the Hulu if you squint, right? Like,
I took out a Vudu account. Still had to rent it, right? Or something.
Yeah. I had to rent it. It was $3.99 and your first one is 99 cents on Vudu. So I got this movie for 99 cents.
I probably
signed up for some like recurring, you know, every month now it's going to charge me $938 or whatever. But for now I got Suspect for 99 cents and I could not, I mean like literally that may be the best 99 cents I've ever spent.
I genuinely had a fun time watching this. I can't believe I didn't give the shout out. Lydia, I have no idea why, just because she's a great wife. Was texting me ideas for a lot awful movies just because I mentioned it. Like I wasn't even, and she's like, "Oh, how about this one? How about this one?" And I've never heard of this. I had no idea. And I look at Suspect and I see that Cher, Dennis Quaid, and Liam Neeson. I'm like, "Well, we're doing that." And what a great pick by Lydia. So thank you, Lydia. Fantastic.
Lydia never texts me suggestions. I'm a little disappointed.
That's between you and her, I guess. Sorry, I can't. I'm not the boss.
But definitely, she deserves 100% all of the shout-outs.
I think we should do it again
episode.
For next month. No, too far. All right, let's
it'll
get
just
to
be
it.
Yeah, Maud Awful Suspect from here on out. We'll alternate between watching this movie and getting high and watching Matlock. It'll be great.
Yeah, that's awesome.
All right, so we start off with the credit screen, and already like this just takes me back to 1987. Mm-hmm. Like the credits, you get two TriStar Pictures logos. We're 11 seconds in. They run the credits. The credits are out in like 15 seconds, you know, and it's none of this like 6 minutes of logos going by. Like, oh, the 80s were such a good time.
Well, I make this joke a lot about the title sequences being PowerPoint, but holy shit, like this.
Yeah.
This oh, yeah. may have been the title sequence that a young Bill Gates saw or whoever made, I don't know, Microsoft cover, and was like, yeah. let's make a program that does this. Like, exactly
yeah.
this.
This predates PowerPoint by a decade, so yeah. yes, right?
Yeah, that was the inspiration. For 10 years, yeah. he was like, I'll make this font so, and, like, the little background, like, it's raised. The letters are, like, raised out a little bit, but, like, a bad 3D that looks shitty. Oh, it's great.
Fantastic. It is the first Microsoft Word 3D font
yeah.
combined with the first edition of PowerPoint as it scrolls through. And it's like a hard wipe as it goes from slide to slide. It may actually be slides like on a film projector.
I always
wonder
like
overhead
how they,
projectors.
It's amazing how they used to have to do this stuff, you know, like back when they had the MGM and they had the actual fucking lion, you know, and they got like a. They got like the
yeah. They had to bring a lion
card,
into
like
the
in
studio
front of a
every single
face.
Time yeah. to do that. Yeah, right. It was rough.
Yeah.
They went through a lot of lions yeah. back then. But you know,
do you think you okay on the second viewing? I thought, and I wonder if you agree. Do you think whoever wrote the score didn't see this movie?
Yes. Because
like
yeah. this is
it's intense.
So glad you have that note. Yeah,
it's intense. I
think and you probably I'm assuming the answer to this is no, but have you ever seen, I think it's a 1981 Sean Young Harrison Ford thriller called No Way Out?
No.
Sorry, and I said Harrison Ford. It's not Sean Young and Harrison Ford were in Blade Runner. It's it's a really really young Mel Gibson, I think. Anyway, it's
when he
anyway,
was but a
whatever.
Budding racist sexist. Anti-Semite is still developing his anti-Semitism at that time, I'm sure.
I've got to make sure who it is now. Sorry. I want to apologize to Kevin Costner and his family. It's a super young Kevin Costner, right?
Okay.
I don't right. Yeah.
That's
and as soon
bad,
as I say
Andrew,
that, now
you
I get
you went
picture.
Through two
right.
not even close
I
to
did.
Kevin Costner.
I know. So it is it's Kevin Costner, it's Sean Young. I really remember Sean Young from it. That's just the way it goes. And Gene Hackman Gene Hackman is Gene Hackmaning it up
Gene
all
Hackman.
Over the place. So
Gene Hackman has a
no
standing
way,
invitation for any of his movies that want to be on
oh,
a
yeah.
lot off a movie. Anyone that we yeah. discover is a law-related movie, he's in.
Yeah. This movie felt like the writer and director watched No Way Out and was like, oh, yeah, I want to make that movie. It kind of had that. But, yeah, like the music definitely, like, it's as discordant as any right like the I don't know like maybe what tops it is the like super melancholy music at the beginning of the theme from MASH like
yeah
I don't, but
I'm
but
almost thinking like
really
the,
is not a
the
good
Lord
match.
Of the Rings movies except a little yeah. bit more slashy you know like the beginning
right.
of the it's like that but like also a horror twist to it and the thing is if I wonder had they done the old firm like like jazz piano-y thing. I would like how different would the whole tone have been? Because it's not yeah. any darker than The Firm. Like it's kind of like this, you know?
Yeah.
It's weird. Yeah. Anyway.
It is weird. So Cher gets top billing. Cher is 41 during this movie, which is
really?
Ridiculous. Yeah. She's 41.
So she's 107 now?
Yeah, she is. I believe exactly 107 right now.
Yeah.
And she looks amazing. And she looks amazing. Period. She looks extra super duper amazing for 41. And this is really peak Cher. This is the movie that comes right in between Witches of Eastwick and Moonstruck. So if you love Cher, and
here's the
and
thing,
who doesn't?
Yeah, we talked about this. I love Cher for less reason than anybody in history. I think like there's because there are a lot of people. I'm not claiming I love Cher more than anybody. I'm not. But for some reason, I love Cher, and it's based on almost nothing. Like, I haven't even seen Moonstruck. I haven't seen probably any of the other movies you're going to say are great. I've seen exactly Mask and this. Like, that's it. And yet I'm like, I love Cher.
So you love her for just being the mom in Mask. Yeah,
just
huh?
the that's, way that's... she, I don't know, the way she is. I mean, you know, plus I love, I got you, bit, like, you know, like that.
So, well, yeah. Everybody, I mean, you know, you did a special on Groundhog Day over on Philosophers in Space. Weird. So like you got the repeat of the movie doing the repeat of I Got You, Babe. So yeah. I can see how that earworm stuck.
So we agree
with you.
On
I will
Cher.
Send you. You can maybe even link it in the show notes. It's an Esquire magazine quiz of which Cher are you? And it's like 13 different. It's like we're all a Cher in some way or another. Which Cher are you? It's fantastic.
I'm old right. folks home Cher. Is that where? No, never mind. Sorry.
Old, yeah, old the one joke. Where she actually went to the. It was like the 2010 MTV Video Music Awards and like told the makeup person. It was like reported out. Told the makeup person like, yeah, I'm the oldest person here wearing the least amount of clothes, which is pretty much peak Cher. So, all right, so. It's Cher, it's Dennis Quaid, it's Liam Neeson, it's John Mahoney, that's Frasier's dad. I will be calling him Frasier's dad from here on
out.
We
agree.
And Joe Mantegna, Juan Juan, Fat Tony, like Joe Mantegna in like his 30s too. He's great.
And you can hear just a little bit of Fat Tony. It's so great.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely
love
it.
Yeah. Oh, it is. So we get more great 80s movie making, right? Like We come right out of the title card, and we get a 1 second establishing shot of the Supreme Court.
Right.
Like in the 1980s, the movies were like, "Fuck you, pay attention." Right?
It's like, almost
none
like,
of these like,
yeah, like one of those. What do you call it? The little message, hidden message. What do you call that again?
Yeah,
I'm blanking on
yeah,
this.
Subliminal messages. Yeah. Yeah,
it's almost like they wanted us to subliminally think there was a Supreme Court.
Yeah. So the whole movie's like that, right? Like it's like, yeah, you get 2 seconds max for establishing shots. And then if they're not watching, then fuck them. The movie will make no sense. So I approve of that 80s movie makers. So we see it's the Supreme Court. And then this woman comes in who's going to turn out to be the murder victim. But the first time you watch it, I thought she was the clerk or assistant or whatever.
I too was confused.
The movie. There's a lot of confusion in watching this movie only once. And she comes in. She calls him Justice Lowell, Mr. Justice, and already like I'm loving this movie. Right? Like there's none of this like someone coming in and calling a sitting Supreme Court Justice Frank. Right? Like no. It's,
okay, but for a split second in my head, I was truly wondering if they named the character Mr. Justice and he was going to be. like figure in this justice movie, and I was like, please, because she says, "Bye,
Justice,
Mr. Justice,
a la major, right?"
And here's what I have to say about this guy. First off, this is all filmed like an 80s PBS mystery. Like it's hard to say exactly what it is, but just the way the camera moves, you know, it doesn't cut. It's like you're in one room. Like it looks like Poirot is gonna solve a crime in a minute. And also, this might be a deep cut for you, but why is the Supreme Court Justice of the United States played by like Cyril Richard? It's really weird. I don't know if you know who that is. He's the guy from the Captain Hook from like the Peter Pan TV thing.
Yep.
Yeah, he's practically like, oh yes, I've been working at the Old Bailey. The Supreme Court of the land, of course. That's where I've done my lore. I mean, law.
Yeah.
Like, it's weird. He's got, I don't know if it's a British actor or they're going for some weird mid-Atlantic-y thing, but.
Yeah, well, I don't want to do too many spoilers, but like, it was one of those. I had the same note, and then you get to
really?
The end
of the
movie.
The Cyril Richard reference? We both came up with that one?
No,
yeah, I mean,
I did not.
Let's face
I did
it,
not
I mean,
have
it was an obvious
one.
Joke. I don't even know why I bothered to make it.
I had the mine was the more pedestrian, not believable Supreme Court justice. And then I was like, is that intentional? Is it foreshadowing? And then the Supreme Court justice, because it's 1987, takes out Chekhov's rifle. and two notes. So serious legal note on this. This is 1987. So A, it's a rifle because everybody in the fucking country, right, knew that you can't have handguns in the District of Columbia, right?
Yeah.
So it's this like beautiful antique rifle, and he takes it out and he's like polishing and looking down the scope.
And he throws off his actual secretary, comes in, and is like, oh, yes, gonna bag of turkey for Christmas dinner. I'm American. A bag of turkey for, yeah, that kind of thing. But I love this
he did
guy
kind of
commits,
alternate between the British and the, you know, I'm going to bag a turkey for,
He's not quite, it's better that he just does the Cyril Richard than the Mr. Doctor Strange. I am your Doctor Strange here. But it's, he commits what, this is going to sound weird to say, he commits probably my favorite suicide that I've ever seen, which is, he's like in the middle of his day, and he's still like doling out errands and stuff, and he's like, oh, well, here's your Christmas bonus, girl is going to get killed in a minute, and here's, would you remind my wife to go to the grocer and pick up some groceries? Well, okay, tell you.
Hey, pennies worth of cherry tomato. Right.
Yeah, here is tuppence for you to pick up the... And then he's like in the middle of... Like he just sends his secretary away with another mundane task. Okay, and I'll go see little Billy for Christmas. And then he's just like, here's the gun. Blow my head out. Like just in the middle of it, like which is...
You were slightly alighting over the fact that the cinematography here, like he's holding the gun up and down, and the rifle is shot as phallic as any object in any movie, excepting maybe the rocket ship.
Cher is a gay icon.
Other than the rocket in Flash Gordon, it is huge and phallic, and then he sticks it in his mouth.
It's a shotgun. And, that's how Kurt Cobain did it. There's nothing. But it's such a routine suicide that I had to admire it. In its way, it was very British, you know. Yeah. Like I think, that's but anyway,
true.
We spent
so that's
too
the
much
that's the
this.
Intro scene. That's the background for this Supreme Court justice commits suicide, and already like like the rest of the movie forgets that happens, right? Because it there's a political thriller, and we'll meet and we'll learn about the political subplot or whatever. And like all of this, like a Supreme Court justice died in 1987 in real life, really? Right? Like this even back then, that's how Kennedy got on the court. Even back then, like the political question would not be like, can we pass the farm bill? It would be who's going to be on the Supreme Court. But movie forgets that. But we then cut away. There's no, because the movie is like, fuck you, pay attention. There's no like time passes. I think it's like a couple of days, right? Like but the first
knows?
Time you watch the movie,
who
knows? you're not clear. It cuts away to the Potomac. Other sidebar, great thing about this 80s movie making, about this in particular, this is shot on location. Everything they say is a thing in the movie, with one exception, is actually the thing in the movie, right? So the Potomac is the river that separates Maryland from the District of Columbia. And you see a bunch of like old guys disrobing to jump in the Potomac.
Let me talk
in
about
December.
This.
Go ahead.
So this is the little polar bear thing that happens. And what I love about this is like one Foley guy had to do. So this is, you know me, I always notice when it's dubbed. I always notice when the fucking Foley is on and it's not really the sounds of what we're seeing. I just, every time it bothers me, but it's fine. Whatever. I meant, you know, movies have to do this, but this was great because a bunch of naked, hairy old men or whatever, old men in thongs or whatever, they're going to jump into the river. And one Foley guy was like, okay, so each guy's going to have a different thing. So you hear this like, oh, come on, polar bears, it's not very cold. And then they all jump in. You hear one guy go like, whoa. And then one guy's like, wee. And then one guy's like, whoa. You know, like he's got all these different little yips for when they jump in. It's my favorite kind of Foley. I loved it.
I did not have a Foley note here. I had a, this is a real thing done by real idiots in the real Potomac River. And then while they're doing that, the camera passes over again, not really very long in the shot. And the woman from scene one, Elizabeth Quinn, has been murdered. But you can't really tell that unless you've watched the movie twice.
On the second time,
she's covered
like,
in dirt.
Oh,
yeah.
She's the one who was murdered. I don't even.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, the first time I'm like, I think that's the justice's aide. I don't know. But
yeah, Mr.
Like,
Justice.
You see Mr. Justice for like 8 seconds. Yeah. So, and she's wearing like beige and she's buried in dirt. And anyway, so there's a beige thing that has been, and this would have been in like standard def on TV in the 80s too. You would have been like, oh, that brown pixel, that must
be
the
murder. I'm
pretty
sure they would have thought it was just river garbage. Like you can barely even tell. It's like,
And so the polar bears discover the body. Now then we cut again to cops are sort of swarming all over the Potomac, and they encounter crazed hobo.
What happens is they're searching the drain pipes, and they come across a man with a certain set of skills, if you know what I mean. That would be Liam Neeson. And here's what I love about Liam Neeson. Couple things. First off, Liam Neeson has always been an old man. He's one of those guys. I think it's his hairline. I'm pretty sure if you have an old guy hairline, you're always perpetually. He doesn't look bad, but he's always 50. In this movie, he was fucking like 35 or something. He looks 50. And the other thing I want to say is they find Liam Neeson, and Liam Neeson just starts beating the crap out of cops. Like, he just full on just beats him. And you know what that means? That means he's not the guy, because of course, you can't have the guy who's the, you know, who did it wouldn't be out beating up cops when you discover him. That's too easy. Otherwise, where's the movie? Yeah. So he's just beats the living crap out of like two or three cops. And I just got to say about, you know, after we had that whole Liam Neeson controversy that, you know, I recorded some SIO about where he talks about it, you realize like the casting process must have been like, well, Mr. Neeson, what are your hobbies? What do you like to do? Well, I like to go around and just beat the living shit out of random people. Oh my God, this is him. We found him. No more. It's him. No lines either. You're not going to talk, just beatings. That's all you do the whole movie. Right.
Yeah, and in this scene, and there's one other where he tries to do, he's actually trying to do the mountain from Game of Thrones, like where the little like eye gouge skull crush thing to one of the cops. Like it is like he's picked him up by his head and is like trying to crush his skull. And it's Liam Neeson, right? Like it's Liam Neeson is like 152 pounds.
Oh, he's a tall guy though. Like, oh. But ironically, a guy who looks like Rodney King, then Rodney Kings him. That's the ironic part of this.
Yes.
Just beats the crap out of him, which, you know, I guess he kind of had it coming if he beat up two or three cops.
We have come full circle, because this movie, I would not call it as pro-police, right? Like, the police are constantly, like, beating the crap out of Liam Neeson. And it's not, right, so it's not, like, firmly anti-cop either, right? Because Liam Neeson has it coming, because he's a violent sociopath.
The guard jokes, you keep this up, you're gonna find yourself, you know, hanged in your cell. Like the guard is like,
That's the move. So the movie is not building up a, like, you know, the pro thin blue line kind of thing. All right, so cops eventually subdue, drag Liam Neeson away, and we smash cut over to Cher looking all Cher-y in her car.
This is incredible.
She is literally wearing a raspberry beret. which just couldn't have made me happier. And she is listening, as all of our protagonists do, to KXP radio, all exposition all the time. even though we're literally 6 minutes into the movie, and unless you have that memento disease, like you don't need exposition. But you know,
so the car is saying, I don't know. I felt like I had the memento disease watching this. This is fan-fucking-tastic, because what happens here is Cher gets attacked by Antifa. Like, there's just I don't know. Like, this is like Andy Ngo's idea of what Antifa does. Like, there's a roaming gang of like nine criminals that, while she's sitting in traffic, this is incredible. I've watched it twice. I still can't believe this scene happens. She's sitting in traffic waiting to get to her public defender job, in which she's obviously going to wind up as Liam Neeson's lawyer. And she's just sitting in her car waiting. A gang comes, crushes her windshield with a rock.
Yep.
Okay, that's step one. Pulse opens
both doors to the car.
And then just opens the door and steals like the crap that's on her seat and steals her necklace. They don't smash her window. They just, like, they don't smash it fully open. You know, like the rock just goes in the window and kind of crushes it in. And then they're like, oh, wait, I didn't need to do that. The door's open. I could just do that. So, like,
they steal a, like, worthless costume jewelry thing from around her neck and some legal papers from her passenger seat.
I've got a question for you, though, Andrew. Do you think this will factor in any way into any part of the movie at all at any time in the next hour and 54 minutes?
I really, really thought it would, and the movie told me to go fuck myself. Yep. Yeah, no, this scene is
absolutely
oddly specific. Right, yeah. It is
practically, the best you could say for it is, she's a couple minutes late to her appointment, like to her job.
Which and doesn't matter. Which doesn't matter at all.
Yeah, like, and I guess not, like, you could maybe argue that Frasier's dad is kind of peeved at her, and so he gives her the case for that reason or something.
It's a different assignment.
Oh, yeah, too. You're right. I'm doing my best, but like, this is the weirdest thing to ever happen. This is peak crime wave movie, I think.
Yeah. This is Grand Theft Auto 3 brought to life on the screen, right? Like running up, smashing the windshield, opening the door, and getting ready to – but they don't throw Cher out of the car and steal
the windshield, isn't how they get in the –
No, like, yeah, it's
fuck
great.
You, here's a so, rock in your windshield, and now, oh, I'm going to open the side door and grab all the stuff on your – Oh, so good.
So, as you point out, this is meant to establish that that Lady Lawyer Cher is a an overworked public defender. She's driving a Chevy Chevette, which is an unbelievably shitty car. Even whether the windshield is broken or not,
I've never heard of that.
No. It is absolutely a real and look, the mid 1980s were the absolute nadir for American automobiles, right?
Yeah.
We had my parents had an AMC Pacer, and we have listeners who grew up with a fucking AMC car. Like it's the worst. They're the worst cars ever made. I would much rather have grown up with a Model T, like crank the radiators at the beginning than ride in that fucking
Pacer.
One
way you know how bad 80s cars were is that, like, I recently got a new car and I just turned in my 10-year-old car to the dealership. That fucking thing felt brand new. The 10-year-old shitty Hyundai that was totally fine. To me, it felt like a new car still worked perfectly fine. Whereas if you had done that in the 90s, if you had a 10-year-old car in the 90s, it was going to explode. Like, there was no chance. Yeah. It couldn't even drive.
Yeah. No, that's right. So in the era of the worst cars ever made, the Chevette is one of the very worst of those cars, right? So that's all meant to say, like, she's given up, a chance at riches.
But
to,
see,
to
I
do
like
what's right.
Do you like? Because I like this part. I like how they establish her. Because I've learned from this show, like the public defender, or whatever. You know, this is not a lucrative gig. She's overworked. She's underappreciated. You know, and I kind of liked it. I liked how they did it.
I love two things about this. So number one, I love the fact that this movie picks as its protagonist the public defender, when this is the 80s and the 80s and 90s, as we know from doing 30 previous Lord-awful movies. Like, the biggest trope is, I'm a defense counsel, but like, my client is guilty, and and we are supposed to sympathize with the prosecutors. And this movie is like, no, fuck that. We're not sympathizing with the prosecutors. Sympathize with the poor, overworked public defenders who are out there. So I really love that kind of ethos to the movie. And then number two, for 1987, it's shockingly progressive, right? Like, her coworker, right, a slightly older, big, fat male public defender, like, who's her friend, is clearly, like, deferential to Cher, right? Like, it's not
right. –
she's not in there, like, getting
this,
him
by
coffee
the way,
and
is
crap like that.
Fred Melamed or whatever his name. You would know him. He looks nothing like he looks now in this movie. It's weird. Like, I could tell it was him.
Yeah?
But he's in a bunch of stuff, and like, it's hard to think of like one thing where you definitely know him. He's just in a bunch of stuff. What's like the best thing? I don't know. He's just in a bunch. Did you recognize him or?
Because I didn't recognize him, but like I did recognize, and it's why I knew the judge wasn't Judge Fraser's dad, which we're about to spoil. But that judge is Bill Cobbs, whom I had to look up, who is a great character actor who's been in everything.
Yeah.
Right? Like,
well,
every
that's
kind
of this guy,
show
too.
That's,
he's
yeah,
been in a
that's
bunch
needed
of
like an
little
African-American
things.
Judge or priest or lawyer. Yeah, like, you cast Bill Cobbs, and he's cast here as the black judge, like, and he's great. And, you know, he assigns Cher to I don't even remember what Liam Neeson's character is. His character's name is like A. Whitney Brown or something. It doesn't matter. He's Liam Neeson. We will call him Liam Neeson throughout the rest of this.
Carl.
And there's a little bit of a cut back and forth. We get to see Cher eating peanut butter out of a jar with a spoon. And she all of a sudden has an insight. She runs in. She realizes Liam Neeson has been uncooperative and the court has ordered court-ordered counsel because he's not talking to anybody. And she realizes he's not talking to anybody because he's deaf. And then because it's 1987, Liam Neeson writes on the notepad, deaf and dumb, which for those of you who are not 40, dumb is what they used to call mute back in the 1980s. So he is deaf and mute, and now Cher has figured that out. That's super convenient that we don't get to hear Liam Neeson's rich, thick Irish brogue as he is supposed to be.
I was just thinking the same thing. If they're like, well, we can't have him have that accent. But also what I love about, again, what innocent man Liam Neeson does when his lawyer is meeting with him in the jail cell is tries to kill her and beats the crap out of her because, you know, that's what the guy who will end up not being the guy would do once. You know, I get that he's like a traumatized, troubled guy, but like how many vicious attacks of innocent people can we give our troubled, you know, misunderstood Vietnam vet? You know, like at a certain point, you get to the point where like, well, maybe just find him guilty because fuck it. He's about to kill somebody any minute. Like you can't have him attack like five innocent, you know, nurses and doctors and police and lawyers. Like, come on. It's a little too much.
Yeah, I think that's right. So, okay. So that sets up. We now have had our meet. It's not a meet cute, but we now have had our meet between Cher and Liam Neeson. And so we cut over to introducing Dennis Quaid. And again, we get that 1 second establishing shot of the Capitol. And Dennis Quaid is the way to think about this is did you watch Thank You for Smoking?
I can't actually remember if I did.
Yeah. Anyway, it's a comedy and Aaron Eckhart plays the tobacco lobbyist, right?
Right.
Aaron Eckhart's character is method acting of Dennis Quaid in this movie, right? Like Dennis Quaid is just the like, and he's so great. Like, and the movie is really well written here, right? Because he's lobbying for farm subsidies who you're supposed to think are kind of the bad guy. They're never really the bad guy.
All right. Like, let's talk about this. What the fuck? I feel like part of what ruined this movie was that they had a movie and then they're like, but we need a pretty mediocre white guy to do a bunch of stuff and then be not really a great character, but still in the end be loved by the woman because it's the 80s. Because we get a whole drama about this fucking farm subsidies bill. And we get, and there's a whole B plot to it, like just a bunch of minutes dedicated to this. And as far as I can tell, it's absolutely irrelevant to everything else going on. Not only, as you say, the buzz on the fucking, on Capitol Hill would be a justice, you know, an old British justice and a great actor, British actor from the 50s and 60s has killed himself. That would be what the news would be. But no, they're like he's trying to get those last couple votes on a farm subsidies bill. Like, are those a big deal? I feel like those are the ones that just pass because everybody's like, farm subsidies, you know? And then he tries to do so. By the way, I love this because he tries to wheel deal with a female member of Congress. And he says, Andrew, maybe you could fact check. Is this how this works? He's like, okay, I got farmers, you know, because I'm farm subsidy man. And, they make milk. And I know your state has a state lunch program. How about we donate milk to the state lunch program? Just like, I don't think that's how laws work. Like, for 1 year of some donated milk. Because, like, if the state has budgeted for a state lunch program, they're just going to be like, we have the budget for this. We do this. That's how state budgeting works. You can't really, like, donate to the budget, you know? It's just weird.
Yeah, no, that you wouldn't be able to do any of that. But again, so two things. Number one, this whole like farm bill is the MacGuffin of this movie. It's one of the MacGuffins of this movie, right? Like it's designed to distract you and make you think like, ooh, is it right? It means nothing. And then also we meet Catherine Kerr here. She's the she's Congresswoman. And again, like great, like. shockingly progressive kind of portrayal here. She's almost exactly like a handsome. I think the actress is 50 in this, and right, and she's kind of meant to be like, oh, she's a handsome.
She's a cougar.
Older woman.
She's a cougar.
Yeah, right. And 80s and cougar. So again, like not. At a time in which a lot of 80s movies were like, you know, this would have been portrayed, you know, either by a 24-year-old in stilettos, yeah, or by, you know, Barbara Bush, right? Like there was not a lot, yeah, of like, well, you know, women of an advancing age can be.
I know. It's tough, though, because 80s cougar is just pretty much like my mom's age. Like that's the. So it's, this is.
Ooh,
a,
okay.
It's
right,
like trying
enough,
to be a
enough.
Cougar when the hairstyle and the clothes is just like, that's a tough. For me, personally, I'm just talking about me. That's a tough
understood
age.
Understood, yeah. Well, I had a slightly different experience in the 80s, so we don't need to go there. So we meet Dennis Quaid doing his Dennis Quaid-y stuff. It's intercut with the witness prep where Lady Lawyer Cher is interviewing Liam Neeson, and this is the first point, right? So Liam Neeson, deaf and mute, so when they communicate with him, they do so via writing. Either he writes on a legal pad, or later on there's a great like 1980s computer setup that enables him to communicate. And you realize that this is the first point in the movie where you realize there's a reason why this scene in normal movies goes rapid fire, because it makes no fucking sense when you have time to think about it, right? So Liam Neeson says, Cher is like, you got to help me get, you know, give me something so that I can, you know, get you off for this crime. And Liam Neeson writes, Michael was there on the chalkboard. Now, if you're a normal human being moving at normal speed, you will look at the screen and go, well, who the fuck is Michael? And right. How do you know what his name is? But if you are Cher delivering the lines that are written in the script, you will say, okay, so how tall is Michael? Are there any distinguishing characteristics? Mm-hmm. Right? Like, she's just doing the police details, and all of that works when you're going super rapid fire. But when you're going really slow, you're like, no, wait, like, and we never learn how he knows who Michael is. Like, you know,
well,
I think
it's incredibly fucking confusing, but I think he and Michael were actually friends. That's my theory.
They could have been lovers. Like he could have been the big spoon in that tube that we found him. Like, who knows? We never get to find out. Yeah.
Well, no, we kind of do. I mean, we'll get to it, but it is weird.
Yeah. Well,
and like you're saying, I mean, she's having to do the detective work, I guess. A lot of that, you know, that good stuff.
Yep.
I just want to ask, you know, again, like I asked before, farm subsidies bill. You know, there's political intrigue here. There's murder. There's all this. Do you think the bill will end up mattering? Will it be part of a vast conspiracy? There's money, and the reason there was a murder because who knows? Or will it just be absolutely fucking nothing? I ask you, Andrew. What do you think?
This is I will say, and so maybe this is a little bit of spoilers, but like this movie is the opposite of The Firm. How about that? Right. like all of these secret extra special, like it's not like they connect up in some
nothing,
grand.
It's
just like
weird.
Nope.
Yeah. This movie was written just to try to get you to think someone else is the bad guy. That's the only reason for anything.
Yeah.
But sorry. Right. So Michael was there. Where are we? We're Fraser's Fraser's dad. I
right.
Think.
We learn. Yeah. Yeah. And now that's right. Now, we hard cut away to Judge Frazier's dad, and this is not the first time in this movie where, again, I've had to watch this twice because there are a lot of like old white dudes in the movie, and they're only on screen. Like Frazier's dad is Frazier's dad. We know who he is. But like here, he's talking with a fellow judge who, spoiler alert, will look exactly like the dude who's the assistant attorney general,
really?
Whom I will call Bill Barr.
Oh,
yeah, I thought he did.
I thought it was that guy. Okay.
Yeah, no, I did too the first time through, right? But he says, because I was going to ding this for being bad law, because it's
clearly
like... Oh, no,
this
like,
is where he has to, like, wrangle the case from the guy.
He's,
okay,
he's trading.
Yeah.
He's trading cases with the judge. Yeah. So this judge is a one and done.
He
judge
says, and I love it.
Dad,
we get more law. He's like, well, rumor is I'm up for, you know, federal appointment or whatever, like in the vacancy. So I have a case here that, let's go through our trading cards of cases here. I've got one that's going to last a year, and you've got one that's a quick one and done, just a quick vagrant, you know, Liam Neeson, a man with a certain set of skills. How about we trade, because I don't want to have any long cases that I just kind of have to abandon when I get this appointment. So how is that accurate?
So two things here. First, the judge trading thing does indeed happen. And that part is not unrealistic. But when a court reassigns a case from one judge to the other, that does become part of the public record. So, you know, keep that in your back pocket. Like this sort of happens sneakily, right? Like we know when a case is filed, it is assigned if a court, and this court has special assignment, it's assigned to a judge, and then if the judge moves it, that becomes a part of the record. So, you know, which is maybe not consistent with the portrayal later on. There's a real problem here that is one of these that only lawyers watching the movie are going to get taken out of. But once I tell you, hopefully it will ruin it for all for you and for all of us listening as well. And it is this, the motivating plot of the movie involves the correct succession of judges sort of up the federal chain. Right. Mm-hmm. And so the Supreme Court justice who'd killed himself came from the Circuit Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, right? That's Merrick Garland's court, right? That's the court that Brett Kavanaugh came out, right? It is, in fact, a feeder court for the Supreme Court. And judges frequently get to the D.C. Circuit from the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia. So all of that makes sense if you're talking about and Judge Fraser Crane's dad is a judge in the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia, getting ready to be bumped up one level to the Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, the movie and what I think is, I think the movie hired somebody like me. And then here's the problem. They were just like, go fuck yourself. It's a movie, right? Like, right. We're not going to fix it, because clearly everything else about the movie is in state court, right? Like, this is a murder, right? It's not.
Yeah,
it is. It's not a federal crime. And so the movie, to paper over that, never calls the court by the right thing. Mm. It's super, and again, right, it's just like one of those.
So this isn't some weird like DC rule, like because it happened in the district, you know, like
nope, because the District of Columbia has its own state court system, right? And so murders go to the Superior Court of the District of Columbia. That's the trial court there. We will see a file labeled later on during the chase, during the Mission Impossible kind of sequence, that is labeled District of Columbia District Court. That's not a thing, but it's close to the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia. You just reverse them. So I think they initially, like, the script writers didn't know the difference between state and federal court. And Andrew they hired was like, is it state or federal court? And they were like, what, 1% of our audience is going to care about that? Never. No, go to hell.
Really, the least of our worries in the law. In this movie, it gets pretty crazy.
Yeah, that's true. But so that's what's going on. You have to assume that that this is so. Judge Fraser's dad is about to be elevated to the D.C. Circuit, and he is horse swapping the case with his buddy, old white dude who looks like the guy who I call Bill Barr later on, but isn't. Mm-hmm. And that's the whole point of that scene. Then we get to go back to Cher in her office. And this is some good law and going on, right? Like they're talking about, she's talking about the case with her big fat friend. And everything about this is totally ringing true.
Right. Like, that's what I thought too. And I was going to ask you listener, Thomas asked question, because she kind of goes through, first off, he's like, you know, prosecutor owes me a favor. What do you think about the guy says, what do you think about a plea deal and cut your losses? And she's like, well, the guy has nothing to lose. Right. Liam Neeson has zero to lose, so why bother? Which is interesting. And then she kind of goes through all the different like motions she's trying to do, you know, like just to just to do, because you do, you know, I've learned from you, like, you're a lawyer, you gotta, you do kind of go through the motions, as they say. And one of them, she says, though, and I'm actually curious if you know the answer to this, she says failure to properly Mirandize. And I wonder if that's because he's deaf. Like, is there some special rule with that? Like, if they arrest a deaf man and they say, oh, you have the right to blah, 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 and then they come later on, they find out, you know, like, oh, he actually never heard any of that. How does that work?
Yeah, I think that that's exactly what you're meant to think here, right? That they read him his rights, but they did it behind his back and whatever. And Cher, so she goes through, right? The three motions she says are motion to dismiss, failure to properly Mirandize, motion to suppress for illegally searching and seizing evidence, and then motion to dismiss for insufficiency of the evidence. Those are, in fact, the three motions that if you were a public defender, you would bring in this case.
And then is the other one going to be like, look, that storm drain was his house. You can't just walk into there.
That's exactly right. Yeah. That is exactly right. And again,
that's why I'm saying there's a lot of good law in this. There's like a ton of good law.
Oh,
and they don't even make it explicit either. It's like it's almost the background of everything, which that's what told me there were lawyers who worked on this.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So, and then Cher just kind of rolls her eyes and she's like, I'm going to try, but like, that's not going to go
anywhere.
Not
worth the solid gold paper it's printed on.
Right.
Whatever the Futurama joke is.
And that's true, right? Because ultimately, like, the court is going to listen to these motions and they're going to say, they're going to apply the good faith exception, right?
Yeah.
They're going to be like, the cops acted in good faith. They didn't know. And the error here was harmless. It's not like they beat a confession out of Liam Neeson. I mean, they beat the crap out of him, but they didn't beat a confession out of
Your
him.
Your Honor, this was a standard beating. There was no
that's right.
Standard issue 80s police beating. Nothing wrong with it.
Yeah. And so she's right. Like, she's not going to win on any of those.
But they were all plausible and interesting.
They were all absolutely the things you would argue.
I love this. This is a
but you would also know as a
movie.
Lawyer. Yeah. That
perfect
you're not gonna
lot
win. Off a movie. Yep. And now we just had some great law. So now we've got to do like stupid, like time machine things. We immediately cut away to voir dire in the courtroom with Judge Frazier's dad. Well, before that, we get Dennis Quaid being a smarmy dickhead about getting out of jury duty.
Yep.
Right.
Well, so, I just want to say, he's like flirting it up with the kind of the overweight security woman, and I which is great. But his character in this movie is, I want to fuck every human being on the planet. Like, that is literally, someone told him, like, here's your acting note. You are trying to get in the pants of everybody. You are not. Your sexuality is it breathing and human? You're into like, right? I mean, he's like trying to charm the pants off of just everybody. Like, it's nonstop.
Yeah, no. Two things. So number one, I was thinking of the somewhat impolitic but still funny George Carlin joke where he was like, I never fucked a 10, but one night I fucked 5 2s, and I think that should count. But I was really thinking, and I'm not going to name because some former colleagues of mine do listen to the show. They'll probably know who I'm talking about, but I practiced law with an exceptional trial lawyer, and like, he did this kind of stuff, right? Like, he would go in and like flirt with the court reporter, the stenographer, the guard at the courthouse. Like,
is that a good strategy, or he just was very horny?
He
man.
Was a very successful trial lawyer. Okay. I mean, I have no idea how far it went, but he acted the exact same way. So like, this kind of personality trait sort of rang true to me, right? Of the
I also
like,
quickly, yeah,
I'm
I
on all the time.
I also had a Thomas S. question that ended up being stupid. Because the first time I watched this, I actually thought he was a senator. I didn't get that. Just up to this point.
Yeah, yeah.
I figured it out eventually. But like, up to this point, they were kind of just talking about votes and stuff. And I didn't know, like, oh, is he just trying to whip votes or a representative or whatever? So I was going to ask you, are they exempt from, do you ever get a, like, you know, sitting senator or member of Congress that has to report to jury duty, or are they exempt from all that? I was just curious.
So, I don't know if you are if you're a sitting member of Congress, if you are automatically exempt, right? Law enforcement officials are not automatically exempt, and lawyers aren't automatically exempt. So,
but they all get rejected out by one of the two sides. Usually.
But obviously, like you would never, right? You wouldn't even have to use a peremptory challenge. You could just like remove a sitting lawmaker for cause. You know, particularly in today's day and age where, you know, their political viewpoints would be, you know, instantly apparent in the room. And even if they didn't, there is, they make up a thing like Dennis Quaid is like, where do I go for the hardship exemption? And I can't tell if it's a joke.
Yeah, I know. Me neither.
Right. The guard at the door is like, well, you go to the hardship exemptions clerk, right?
Yeah. Or it was like, I think she says like the juror excuses clerk or something like that.
Right. It's something great.
Yeah, it's great.
And he's like, I do that. In reality, what happens is the judge will say, if there's anybody that can't serve on this jury, you know, line up and we'll hear your excuses.
Yeah.
And you get to go pitch them to the judge. Hey, I'm a sitting member of the Congress and need to go vote. That would absolutely work.
Right? Yeah.
The judge would be like, okay.
But if you were like, hey, how are you doing? I would like to have sex with you because you are a human and you're breathing. Hey, judge, your honor. Your honor, do I call you your honor while we're doing it? Yeah. Oh, yeah,
judge,
your honor.
Sexy pants. Yeah.
And B, I'm a high-powered lobbyist, so clearly I work too hard for this. And then I think they'd be like, nah, you get your ass on the... We're going to voir dire you right in.
And look, that happened to me when I was a young lawyer. I was called to serve for jury duty, and I got up to give my little hardship thing. And I was like, yeah, I'm about to have an 8-week case in Iowa. And the judge was like, where do you practice, Mr. Torres? And I said, Covington and Burling. And he laughed, and he's like, I'm pretty sure if you get assigned to this jury that they can cover your absence. Why don't you sit down? And I sat down. Now, I didn't get called for that jury, the judge was like, Mr. Important 29-year-old associate.
Is Andrew Covington or Andrew Burling, I think you'll be okay.
Right.
I've got some law questions. We got some voir dire. Any movie that's got voir dire, I mean, already you're scoring points with me.
and they get like the number of peremptory challenges, right? Like it's not, you know, this is not like Runaway Jury where you can strike 87 people and it's just, voir dire
there's a
going
quick,
on in the background.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a quick scene where like a black PI is like trying to get Cher to hire him, or maybe he's just a Cher fan. I love your music. And I just want to note, this guy's also a great character actor. This movie is great. This guy is an amazing actor. People might know him from Deadwood. He played Hostetler. I think it's the guy who works in the stable or something in Deadwood. It's been a while since I watched Deadwood, but he's a great actor too. Lots of great actors.
Don't get too attached to him though. Brother's not going to live in this one.
But we get some. What I did want to ask you about on the voir dire is, so Fat Tony is like, I would like to know your. he asks the juror.
My wife has been most vocal on the subject of the pretzel buns. Anyway,
so good. I could listen to an hour of Fat Tony every lunch.
Yes.
He asks the prospective juror about the death penalty, and she's like, objection, we don't have that here. So what are you doing? You know, like, and they get to a point where they start giving like some weird opening arguments during this. Like she starts sort of lecturing the jurors during this. I just wondered how much of this ran afoul of the law here.
So, all of it is potential. Like none of it is incorrect, right? So the baseline of what happens is, right? So Fat Tony is the AUSA, which by the way confirms that we're in federal court, right? Like that's a federal prosecutor. And so he is AUSA Fat Tony. And he says to, I was going to call him Aaron Eckhart, to Dennis Quaid. He's like, so what's your view on the death penalty? Cher objects that is prejudicial because it would lead the jury pool who is listening to Veneer right here to think that the death penalty might be on the table. It's not on the table because there's no death penalty in the District of Columbia. And the judge, Judge Frazier's dad, says, well, you know, some of us think there should be, to which Cher says, we thank the court for its input, yeah, which is 100% what you do, right? When the judge just expresses that, you're like, yeah, all right.
They already established, by the way, that he's a Republican. That it was just a throwaway line, but it all fit. There's so much that did work about this movie, and a lot that didn't.
And so they get the instruction, right? Cher demands that for prejudicial purposes, that the judge instruct the jury that there's no death penalty in the District of Columbia, which he does. And then they go back to Dennis Quaid has to answer the question, right? And that's what voir dire is like. Like, look, in exercising your peremptory challenges, you get to say, I don't like that guy. And so you have broad latitude to ask pretty much whatever you want. And so you can ask, what are your feelings about capital punishment I've never done this, but you could ask that if it were a civil jury, right? You could, and you could say, like, look, I want to get a sense of, like, you know, what is this guy, what's he going to be like on my jury? So, absolutely. The way it works.
So that works. The other thing, though,
what goes fanciful? Yeah. Your next question.
Well,
is
a couple things.
That.
First, a brief point. This is very valuable. Marty Crane has exactly 80s Joe Biden's haircut. And just like 80s Joe Biden, it makes him look older than when he just had the gray around. You know what I mean? Something about that particular comb over makes him look. He looks older in this than in Frasier somehow, even though in Frasier he had white hair. But, like, something about that combo, it's just something I'm going to remember when I'm older. I'll be like, make a note of this. This comb over, not a good look. If you just go with the, you know, the Silver Fox kind of, you know, thing, it actually looks better. So that's funny because Marty Crane in this movie is like 40. He's not even old. You know, he's like 45, maybe. He's not even old. And but
he's always looked old. Though,
exactly. Yeah. And then the other thing is.
And the mustache is not flattering on him. It is it's halfway in between pencil thin mustache and real mustache.
Is not a Hitler's mustache, but Hitler's right hand man mustache. Like, it's like that level of the super thin. It's like you can't infringe upon the Führer's look, but you're doing something kind of like it.
Well, it's the same if you use rectangular, you know, the area of a rectangle, it would be the same area, surface area as Hitler's mustache. But while Hitler's just mustache is a little square, this is an elongated rectangle. But
it's great. So, but I did want to ask, because there's the, okay, do you have any fucking idea what this was about? You know what I'm going to talk about. So, what's his name? Sorry, hold on. I lost the page. Quaid. Quaid's up, you know, he's under review here. And Cher is like, turn around, Mr. Dennis Quaid. He's like, what? He's like, all right. What color is my hair? And he's like, brown. She's like, does my hair look brown to you? And he said, well, you asked what it is, not what color, you know, like implying that she dyed it black or something.
Right, right. Yeah.
What the fuck is any of this? I don't understand how this factors in. I don't get it. I don't even like, I've watched this twice. I don't understand what this is supposed to be. Can you educate me here?
So I think they're just trying to point out that Dennis Quaid is really, really perceptive here, right?
Okay.
So he parses the question literally when Cher says, what color is my hair? And he says, brown, and you dye it black is implied. And then she's like, turn back around, you know, does it really look brown to you? And, you know, the idea is you would impeach his memory. By the way, you would never do this stunt in
real. Yeah, it doesn't, but also, here, like, right? Why is she doing it? I don't, does she do it with every...
I have no idea why you would
so
do
I'm
that.
So I'm not crazy. It makes no fucking sense.
You're not. And then, again, though, there's so much I love about this movie. Like, as Cher goes to sit down, Dennis Quaid says, well, what if I said black as my answer? And she says, well, I'm asking the questions.
Yeah, exactly.
And, like, it's just a great little moment.
It's great.
Like,
there's so much good luck. I do want to ask, though, because she does start to go on like a general speech to the jurors. And I wonder if that would fly.
You wouldn't get that.
Okay. Because she's like, then everybody on this jury is going to have to know. I'm like, what? Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. No.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So you would not get that.
That's okay.
Yeah. Then Dennis Quaid wanted to get off of jury duty. And by the way, like, it would have been incredibly easy for him to get off of jury duty, right? Later in my career, when I was potentially, I was pre-selected to be on a 7-week triple murder trial.
Wow.
It was it was huge news. It was moved out. It was the murder took place on the Eastern Shore in Ocean City, and they got a change of venue for prejudicial reasons out here to Montgomery County when I was living in Montgomery County at the time. And like all I did was just on my juror questionnaire, you know, it was like, what organizations do you belong to? And I was like, well, I give money to the ACLU, which was true, right? Like I just listed all of the like really liberal shit that I did. And shockingly, like I did not make the cut.
So prosecutors are like, fuck that.
Yeah. Prosecutors would be like, yeah, no, we're not bringing on this, you know, crazy pinko leftist. He's just going to vote not guilty no matter what.
Okay.
So, so it's super easy, right? Like, again, another good George Carlin joke where he was like, yeah, the American judicial system guarantees you a jury of 12 people who are not smart enough to get out of jury duty.
That's a great one.
And so that's what we get. Now we get Dennis Quaid at the party. He is not the first time in the movie where he does a sort of discount James Bond impersonation where he orders his Stoli up with three olives for his martini. And this is where we actually meet Paul Gray, who I will call Bill Barr from here on out. He's the assistant attorney. He doesn't really look anything like Bill Barr, but he's just sort of like vaguely evil. And he's the assistant attorney general. And we learn in this scene that he's womanizer, right?
He's Bill Barr who fucks. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly right. But really, Quaid is here to producers the hell out of our cougar congresswoman.
Is he going to fuck this congresswoman?
Indeed he will.
Indeed he is. He's going to.
Yeah, in the hallway, as far as we can tell. So good on him. And, you know,
cell phone, people could probably get away with a lot back then. I imagine there's no like Twitter photos of like, oh, did you see this guy running off with it? Yeah. No.
Yeah.
This is the 80s.
The 80s were a different time.
Yeah.
Then Dennis Quaid gets some, good for him, and we get to cut away to another part of the story, which is the PI that you mentioned earlier, the guy from Deadwood, is now off to find Michael, whose distinguishing characteristic, I think Liam Neeson wrote this down, is he's got written in Sharpie on his hand a tattoo that's got a cross and it says Jesus the Savior.
Right.
You can actually see, you don't even have to pause the screen, you can see like the O is sort of smudged out.
Yeah.
I have done not just community theater, but like middle school theater where we have done more convincing tattoos than this.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it's like supposed to be a bad prison tattoo or something. I don't know.
Yeah, but a prison tat would, you know, scrape the skin. And anyway, like this is a Sharpie.
Yeah.
In which someone has written Jesus on his hand. And so the PI is there.
This poor PI was told, hey, find a homeless man in the District of Columbia that has something on his hand.
Yeah, and he does, right? Yeah. Like, so greatest.
No
right,
problem.
Greatest
will do.
PI in history. Yeah.
I know. Where's like, his movie? This poor guy, all he does, he wants to serve this guy with a subpoena or whatever to come testify.
Right, to come testify.
And he's like, oh, hi, sir. Stabbed in the eyeball. Stabbed in the eyeball. And he gets just slashed in the face by the guy. Okay. This is the weirdest movie.
And now, mind you, he gets 80s stabbed in the
face. He gets
80s right?
Like, slashed in the face by the guy who also doesn't end up being the murderer.
Right, right. Yeah, he's just another so crazy weird. Homeless guy.
Yeah.
But yeah, the wild swing comes, I mean, not within like the WWF. And I mean like, legitimately the like old 80s, like Hulk Hogan, like I'm going to land near Jake the Snake Roberts and he's going
to
pass out.
Michael did
like,
the foot stomp at the same time to make the sound that he was.
Yeah, exactly right. So he stabs him in the face, stabs him in the face. The PI pushes down on the blood packets that he has secreted under his eyelids,
right.
and now he's blind.
It seems totally unnecessary, by the way. Like, I thought God, the things that I thought this movie was going to do. I was like, oh, did he get him on the eyes because he was going to see something? Like, what? No, it's just a guy who was trying to serve him papers, was meaninglessly slashed by not the actual killer for no reason.
Yep.
Like, it's okay. Yep. Sure.
And we hard cut away over to Judge Frazier's dad, who is being ridiculous. And the movie plays it that way. Like, you're supposed to think, like, oh, he's just being ridiculous, because Cher is like, my witness that I need, who is the alternative suspect in this case, just stabbed a dude in the eye, and maybe, like, I should get a continuance until we can make sure that he shows up in court. And Fraser Crane's dad is like, I can allow this. Right. We get a quick look. Liam Neeson has been de-hobo bearded. Right. And so he has now completed the transition to, like, just cuddly, lovable, really
beats the shit out of random people.
Yeah, he does, but it's so not, like, you're just like, it's Liam Neeson.
Yeah, something about his face. You're just like, eh.
Yeah, he is. He's, you know.
I like Liam Neeson. I've always liked him. I don't know. Can't help it. A question for you, P. Andrew Torres. What are they trying to, because Fat Tony is, it's cute. What happens is that all happens. You're right. And then they're like, all right, opening statements. And then Fat Tony, like, ties his shoe. Or something? What was, but it's very, it's like 1.2 seconds.
Yeah.
Were they trying to play into the, like, he's a high powered, wears nice shoes lawyer or something? I
mean, that could have been, I did not know what that
there's no
was
like
for,
lawyer but, thing that they were doing that you know of.
No, I think it was just expensive shoot to contrast with, I mean, you know, because there's, and again, I love the ethos in the movie, right? Yeah. That's like, oh, the high priced evil prosecutor. And you're like, prosecutors don't make any money either, right? they're not as overworked as public defenders, right? Like, because their funding is guaranteed as opposed to public defenders that where, you know, their budgets get slashed every year. So the hardship is worse, but like, you don't make bank being a prosecutor.
And then I wanted to ask you if his opening statements went. First off, I loved both their opening statements, both the way they give them and the, like, it just struck me as pretty good realism. But he did say, can you get away with this? He said, of all the murder cases I've prosecuted, this one is the most horrifying, kind of thing. Can you do that?
Those are literally my notes. This is the best opening statement in any movie we've seen up until the point where he says that, which is personal advocacy, which we've talked about.
Right.
As a,
okay. I,
a no-no
I was, in that's what I thought of. And I was like, is that going to count? But okay.
But absolutely, as a prosecutor, what you would do is you want to tell the story about the victim, and then you want to set out what you're going to prove. And he does that, right? So he says, right, this is Elizabeth Ross, you know, she was just a cog in this machine here in Washington. Like, she made $17,000 a year. She was a typist. She wasn't an important person in a city that thrives on important people. But she had $9 in her pocket. And what we're going to prove is that, you know, that this degenerate, scary-looking Liam Neeson, pretend he's scary-looking, over here, stabbed her to death for $9, and we're going to show that he was there. We're going to show that he had the motive, right? That the $9, that he was there, that he was sleeping in her car, that he came back, that he ambushed her, that no one else could have done it, right? Like, that's a great opening statement.
Yeah.
And then Cher does the same thing. Like, you get up and you sort of front load the things that are bad, and then you also respond to the characterization. She gets up and she's like, "Yeah, my guy is a hobo. He lives on the margins of society, and he absolutely stole $9 from this woman, because $9 can be the difference between life and death when you're living on the streets. I know it's easy for us to," like, they're both
they're great
opening
statements.
They really,
and
really
I
are.
Like that they're like, part of what movies I think get, or actors or whatever, get wrong is, this is her everyday job. She's overloaded with cases. And yes, you know, we're seeing the case that's in the movie, so, you know, whatever, it's going to be kind of important. But, like, she doesn't deliver it like, I'm giving a fucking Laurence Olivier speech. You know, I like the kind of, roteness of it, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Like, I like every part of this.
Yeah, me too. So, and then I think somebody sent a note to the director that was like, this movie's running long. Can we wrap up the B plot? So we do, right? We just get a quick cut over. Senator and Hot Pants so votes confusing. For Dennis Quaid's bill.
It's so confusing. So he's sorry. This is really blowing my mind. He goes over there and we do this pointless suspense where they're like coming out of the chamber and he's like, do we get it? And he's like, oh, I don't know. You know, like he doesn't know. Did the farm subsidies bill pass? And then finally we find out that the woman he slept with who said her vote wasn't for sale kind of thing, that she changed her vote.
Yep.
And he has a look of anger about it and he's mad. Yes.
I didn't read that as anger.
I watched this two fucking times and I was like, what is this acting? It was like he was annoyed or disappointed. What did you read into that?
I read it as, can we wrap this up? I've got an A plot that I got to get back to. And, but no, seriously, like I thought the only thing I could read this as was, him sort of, feeling like
I did not get it.
I slept with you and you did change your vote and I'm disappointed in you for that, right? Like
that's the only possible way to read it, but I don't really
it's weird.
Get yeah. Like yeah, I mean I he know, wanted but, her to change his vote. I don't know. It was yeah, it was just yeah. a weird thing for them to do. It didn't make any sense.
It was weird, and it was weird to put this in halfway through the movie. But
yeah,
but
and I
did.
Could see had this ended
now,
up being
don't worry about that anymore
at all important. I could see there being an explanation, but you don't get any explanation. He goes over, he finds out his bill that he's been working on passed. He looks mad about it, and then it's the end of that. It's like what? So bizarre.
Yep. And now we get to go back to court, and we get to see Fat Tony is calling his first witness. And again, this is exactly right. This is textbook direct of the forensics examiner, right? So what he does is asking open-ended questions. It's like, so what'd you do? Yeah, you did. Then what did you do? Did you ever see this? Oh, you saw this weapon? Okay. And what did you notice about this weapon? And how did you test the weapon? And then he's established the provenance of the weapon, Liam Neeson's knife, and then moves to admit it into evidence and sits the fuck down. Like, that's what you do. Like, and it's so non-glamorous, right? Like, it's just... but that's what lawyers do. And I loved it. Right. And I love this bit too, because, you're getting this, you don't know why, but you've been beat over the head a little bit with, Judge Frazier's dad is trying to weigh in on the prosecution side in this case. Right. You don't know why, but like he's being a dick.
Yeah, what
right?
possible and, reason could there be?
Yeah. Yeah. and so what he does here is, he adjourns immediately after direct, and you can see Cher sigh.
Yeah.
And it was just one of those that, like, if I'm a lawyer, right, like, I want my opportunity to get up and ask at least a couple of questions, right? If it's close to lunch, I've had this happen
before. He's
tipping
the scales a little bit, but I like, too, that it's kind of a subtle way of doing it there. Like,
It was so great. And he only adjourned for 15 minutes, right? So it is... and it's nothing you can say anything about, and Cher doesn't, right? And but she knows it's a little bit prejudicial. Of like, no, I wanted to get up and like indict this guy's method on, and now like they're gonna remember the positive stuff, and there is a bit where as they're about to adjourn, Dennis Quaid wants to take a look at the photo.
How does that work? He's just like, Judge, Dennis Quaid here. Can I see that murder picture? Is that? Something that happens.
Yeah, you can't ask for that in the typically it practice varies.
Yeah, they can review
court.
Whatever they want once they go to
right decide, once right? once that they are in the jury box, but once they are in deliberations. But you know, it's not impossible. I don't know.
Anyway,
for contrivance, certainly I have seen. Jurors when an exhibit has been passed among the jury box, you know, one might speak up and say, oh, can you hand that back? Like that?
Yeah, give me,
like
give
that
me
went
a hit
past
of that.
Me too
yeah,
quickly.
Didn't...
Yeah. Yeah.
Then we get, so stuff starts to fall off the rails. First, we begin with physics falling off the rails because he adjourns for 15 minutes. And Dennis Quaid somehow in, well, if I time this, it would probably be 16 seconds, has left, gone to the phone, called, left a message with somebody who then delivers the message to Cher to go out and get, like, how did he do all that?
To go out to the payphone and call, and call, which he then answers and conveys the secret information.
It's incredible. Look,
it's time Flash to say this, Gordon. Right? Like, we've talked about how great this movie is.
Yeah. Then it
the
loses
central
it.
Conceit of the movie is unbelievably stupid, right? Yeah. It is. It's time to reveal it now that Dennis Quaid, a boy lobbyist, is on the jury, but is also kind of conducting his own investigation into the trial and communicating that information to Cher, and not very subtly either. Yeah. And all of that is so fucking preposterous that, like, what I decided that I was going to do is I was going to treat this movie like a science fiction movie, right? Like, I was going to be like, okay, this is like watching Spider-Man, right? Like, you have one level of suspension of disbelief. Right. Yeah. Okay. Dennis Quaid has been bitten by a radioactive spider, and instead of just getting leukemia,
what has he been bitten by? He's been bitten by Matlock, I think.
He's been bitten by radioactive shaft. Yeah. Exactly. and I was like, okay, I'm just not. I can't make any more comments because if I did, the rest of my notes would just be, well, this is fucking stupid. So yeah. Suspend your disbelief at a member of the jury conducting his own investigation from this point forward, because that will be a lot of the rest of this movie. But he says,
I mean, I could almost buy. OK, so tell me what would happen, because I could almost believe that somewhere in our great nation's history, someone on the jury box is like, these fucking people are missing something. I want to, like, trying to contact the lawyer somehow, but then would that be instant mistrial or something?
Instant mistrial. You would be dismissed from the jury, and if the lawyer did not immediately report that to the judge, then the lawyer would be disbarred, tarred, feathered, right? I mean, it just they do this like little dance back and forth in which Cher is like, well, jury tampering is a felony, which it is. And he's like, well, you haven't tampered with me yet. And it's like, no, that's not. I get that that's,
yeah, what if
that
the
that's
jury
funny
tampers
because
with
he
you?
Means like, I want to get my dick wet. But no, like that, it's a bilateral street. Like you can't take information. Like when you know that one of the jurors is rooting for you.
So
by
wait a
giving
minute.
You
when Cher sent that email, that was like, if it's what you say, I love it, especially later in the summer.
In the summer. Yeah.
What you're saying is that
that's
was,
what we have. That is that exactly what we have.
Was not acceptable. Yeah. Oh, interesting.
Yeah, not
law.
Acceptable.
Interesting how the law works that way. Huh, okay.
Yeah, it is. So he says, think about the handedness. Cher comes back in and
I gotta say, I mean, of all the things, that would be fucking thing one that the forensic guy would not, like, he's got like two things he can even do. It's a knife. We're pre super, you know, CSI science. One of the two basic things would be like, well, it's a knifey stabby wound and it looks like it went this way. So it's a left hand or it's a right handed guy. Like that would be, that would have been basic stuff.
Yeah. But that's the secret twist is, it's a right handed slash and Liam Neeson is left handed. Cher's cross examination is fucking terrible.
So stupid.
Right. She's asking direct questions. She's like, so you examined the knife, right? You don't need to ask that. They've already asked. And what were your findings? You don't ask that. You say your findings were inconclusive, weren't they? Right. Like all of your cross examination questions need to be leading questions meant to get the answer that they can't weasel out of.
Some lawyer died right here. And then they just lost it. Or it's like they got to a point where like, well, we need more exciting stuff. So we're just going to ruin all your good lawyer work, whoever consulted on this, and we're going to lose it. Because
you could have easily rewritten. It would have served the same purpose. Yeah. It would have been just as snappy. And
well,
you just
also,
rewrite the
correct
questions.
Me if I'm wrong, Andrew, but do you learn in your Harvard Law over there that the only way to enter into evidence the handedness of your client is to say, hey, Carl, to somebody who can't hear, by the way. She says, hey, Carl, catch, and throws something at him, and he catches it with his left hand. Is that the The only way. Yeah. There's
and,
no other.
And good thing he didn't catch that two-handed like, yeah, you know, humans
I know.
Do.
I know.
No, it, but I will say.
Or just
I,
like smacked only... him in the face and like he fell down. That'd be fine.
Yeah. That'd be great. And then he could type on the little computer. He'd be like, I'm deaf, you idiot. Oh, my God. That would have made this movie so great. But no, he doesn't. It's orchestrated to prove he's left-handed. But that comes after. So that moment is stupid, and all of the preceding cross-ex is stupid, except for the actual treatment of the left-handedness itself, in which Cher does exactly what you would do, right? Which is, so you concluded that this you know, forensic pathologist, Dr. So-and-so, you concluded that this went from left to right, correct? Mm-hmm. Yes. And in fact, if I were behind you and right-handed, that's the direction it would go, correct? Mm-hmm. Yes. And if I were left-handed, it would go the other direction, right? Yes. And then she goes to sit down, right? Like, again, they've got to get the question too far in by having her do that gimmicky throw the bag of whatever it is. But up until that, those three questions were correct questions. And like, as a little sidebar, like, it made me think that, like, one of the way, like, we always talk, and there's a way, I think, to redeem this movie, which I'll get to at the end. But I was thinking, like, it would really be fun to do a, like, murder mystery script in which you are following the defense attorney, right? The public defender or the defense attorney. And they do the cross-examination properly. So you see them getting all of these clues and then sitting down, but you as the audience, like, don't know what the hell it means. And, like, you have to figure out the, right? So, like, that's how the murder clues come in. You're like, why is she doing that? I don't understand. And, like, and then at the end, like, the big reveal, it puts it all together and you're like, oh, that's why. And that would be really more much, I mean, that's how trials work. So. Anyway, that doesn't happen here. She asks the left-handed thing. She proves that he's left-handed. Judge Frazier's dad is like, you have one more stunt like that, and I will, you know, search every outhouse, cowhouse. No, sorry, that's Tommy Lee Jones. But and then in an active in the first but not the last active extreme subtlety, Dennis Quaid runs over to Cher's car to chat with her.
Yeah.
And this is 100% jury tampering. Like, you can't chat with the fucking jurors, like, even if they weren't substantively talking. Judge Frazier's dad drives by in the parking lot, right?
Like, I know. So,
yeah,
they keep doing this, like, the guy who you already should suspect is trying to maybe not help Cher out. Keep seeing Cher interacting with Dennis Quaid, but, like, with the thinnest, like, possible reasonable doubt happening, because they're sort of trying to make it out like a spy movie where she's getting it's, and yet he doesn't just say, oh, you're I'm gonna have you disbarred because this is obviously your tampering, you know. It starts so well and then it just goes so off.
So now, as we've said, this is the start of the movie where Dennis Quaid gets to be a private detective. So that's a fun role play to do. I'm out of the movie because what he does is he goes to the parking lot where the victim's car not only was found, but still is
sitting there
for reasons that are written into the movie that make no sense, right? Like, the car would be at the impound lot. It is the situs of a crime. Yeah. It would not still be, like, in a public parking lot.
The parking attendant guy's like, God, they're taking forever with the thing.
And it doesn't have to be. There's no reason for it. Like, it's not central to the plot. It's not tangential to the plot.
Yeah, because eventually she has to share things.
But she could have just gone into the evidence. She could have snuck onto the impound lot, right? Like, she's sneaking onto a lot anyway. It doesn't have to be a public lot. Anyway. Yeah. Dennis Quaid goes and he meets with the parking lot attendant and says, I'm with the court. And here is where it falls off the rails, right? Because the parking lot attendant says, yeah, I got a subpoena. I have to testify, which of course he does. Mm-hmm. He's the person that puts Liam Neeson in the car that night, right? Like, he's a material witness. He will testify. And you know what's going to happen is he's going to be sworn. He's going to come in and he's going to wave to Dennis Quaid in the jury and be like, oh, that that's that guy I chatted with for an hour. And like, and it's all I can think of on this. Yeah.
And by the way, we have to quickly establish that he sometimes writes down the numbers slightly wrong on the license plate for later purposes.
there's so much fun, like, foreshadowing in this movie, right? Like, the milk carton thing, which I thought was super clever and cute, but like, and then there's some just like brick to the forehead, but whatever. Other foreshadowing for a side plot that means nothing is I love this. Dennis Quaid is freezing his nuts off because it's December in Washington, D.C. and it's fucking cold, and it discovers homeless woman down by the site of the crime who's got a little presidential pin, and he trades his shoes and socks for the presidential cufflink. None of that matters in any way whatsoever.
He tries to go to, like, again, if you forget the one major stupid thing, which is he's now investigating, which is terrible, forget all that. Pretend he's like an investigator working for Cher. He sees that there's like a special presidential pin or cufflink or something that he's like, well, only a few people have this because this is a super special presidential gift one. But then later on, I just want to note that, because later on it gets incredibly confusing. I can't tell what, if it was meant to be that way or whatever, but he trades his shoes for it. So there's that.
Yep. Yeah, we really have to, like, get a move on. Like, we're 90 minutes into this. This is, all right. So I will do my best. Okay, and then now we have the bit where Michael tracks down Cher and tries to kill her, but Dennis Quaid again shows up. Like, now he's an action hero. And Michael knifes his blood bag, which Dennis Quaid was carrying around his chest.
Always keep a it's like Flanders. Yeah, always keep a giant piece of Lawrence Krauss close to my heart. Always keep a blood bag taped to my chest. But I know, sorry to again slow you down. Okay, I'm trying. I love this. This movie is so dedicated to trying to throw you off that after you know everything that happens, you're like, wait. So the religious nut, who isn't the killer, you find out, spoiler alert, he's not the killer. No. They've done everything they could to set this up. They've had Liam Neeson say he was there. He's a stabby guy. He's already stabbed a poor black PI in the eyes for no reason. So you're like, okay, this has got to be the guy, right? He's the killer. And then they have him, seek out Cher for no reason. Just, he looks her up in the phone book, finds where she is, and then goes and holds her at knife point to her throat, just like the person who was the murder victim. All that. So all that's true. And yet he's not the murderer. It's so annoying. It really bugs me because it makes no fucking sense. When you go back and reverse engineer it, you're like, oh, you just wanted to do everything you could to make us think other people were the killer.
Yes, exactly. And then the weird thing that happens is we have this, and we don't need to keep going through like Dennis Quaid's amateur PI stuff, like, but we have basically like 3 days of this shit going on, right? Like, he goes to Bill Barr's office and like that, like, and then we go back into the courthouse. And again, I had to watch this movie twice before I realized what was happening. The forensic examiner is still on the stand. Huh. Right. I'm sorry. It's not the forensic. The detective is still on the stand, right? And so, but there's been so much other stuff that's happened. You're like, oh,
the detective's a new. What do you mean? I think that because it was the forensic guy, and then now it's
you're right.
But I will say this. I have to throw this in that we get in a really, really bad kind of male privilege-y thing that, like, just the 80s, you know. So what happens is we're on a dark, nobody around night, you know, middle of the night. Cher's got nobody around and she's already looking suspicious. And Dennis Quaid does the fantastic thing that definitely is a real hit with the ladies, in which he sneaks up behind her and surprises her in the middle of the night, you know, with no one around in the dark, and expects her to be like, oh, you know, like, No. You don't surprise a woman from behind in the middle of the night as a man. Yeah. Like, maybe just yeah. don't. Like, that's not yeah. cutesy. Like, just no. say, that is, hi, that I is am good here. Advice. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's that is very, very good advice. The Cher wastes her terror. Again, this is a terrible cross-examination for all the reasons we said before. She's as bad with the detective as she was with the forensic examiner. But she gets him to explain that there is a place near Union Station. Again, these are all real places in D.C. Where the homeless people are hanging out. And then it's back to Dennis Quaid. He goes there to try and find Michael, who's probably going to be hanging out in this place. And he goes, he finds Michael, and Michael has 3 pounds of spaghetti on his neck, which leads us to believe that he's been.
So he has been slashed.
Slashed in the neck. So now, is Judge Frazier's dad finally going to grant that continuance? Maybe. And here is where you realize that like they've clearly fired their Andrew in this movie, right?
Yeah,
like, because nobody left on the set knows what the fuck a continuance is. Here's what a continuance is. A continuance is we won't do a thing until another thing happens, right?
Right.
But
Marty Crane is like, well, I'm going to think about granting you a continuance, but while I'm thinking, let's just keep doing the
trial. I'm going to not. Yeah, let's keep not having a continuance while I think about whether
trial.
I have
yeah.
a continuance. And Fat Tony, like he's like, I'm inclined to grant Cher's continuance. So what do you think about it, Fat Tony? And Fat Tony says, I don't think a decision should be made on a continuance until more information comes in, which is, of course, the definition of why you get a continuance, right? Like, and even by 1987, Joe Mantegna had played enough law enforcement lawyer, yeah. cop, judge, right? Like, he's been this role like a bunch of, he knows better than that. He should have known what a continuance meant. So the trial goes forward. I haven't mentioned that like her handwriting is delightfully girly throughout this entire movie.
Oh my God.
Right?
I missed a note that I have. Yes, I agree. But when we had the beginning where she realizes that he's deaf and all that, she goes in. So she has that realization. She goes into the holding cell and writes down on a pad of paper. She goes, oh, you're deaf! ! Yeah. I just thought it was such a good, like, oh, you're deaf! Like yelling it at him rather than like question mark, like, oh, are you deaf? It's so funny.
Yeah, and same thing. Like, we have Michael's been murdered, and like I think in the exclamation point is a little heart. Like, it's just it's fantastic. And then Liam Neeson flips the table. IDW Prowl. That's a deep cut Transformers joke for like three of our patrons.
but that's where we learn. I think
they're laughing
friends.
Their asses off because this is totally IDW Prowl.
Okay,
idea,
cool. It's typical IDW Prowl intellectual dark web Prowl did this. And so this is where we, you know, like I said earlier, I guess they must have been friends. Like, it's an odd couple situation for sure, but like mute Liam Neeson and religious
yeah.
savvy.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, that's a good point.
He's like so sad he flips the table. I don't really, it's weird.
Yeah. Yeah. Cher has to call her first witness, but we can't see that happen. So we literally
well, I
just
love it.
See
Marty Crane. Eddie comes in and brings Marty Crane a note that says, and I love this because he's like, he gets to know, he's like, anyway, I'm being appointed to the federal bench. So fuck you. I'm out of here. I take this job and shove it. I don't give a shit about your little murder case. I'm out of here. Marty Crane out. And then he just pieces out of the trial. I love it.
And yet again, right? So the trial stops.
Suck it.
Right?
I didn't like you, bailiff. I didn't like you, typist. I've always thought... You were overweight, sir, over there. Yeah, it's best.
I don't even know who you are, but I'm sure you're a jerk. And then Cher chases after Judge Frazier's dad and says, what about my continuance? And like, he gives her the like double middle fingers as he's descending down the escalator. But like,
to your point,
like,
this
like,
is
that's
a continuance,
the thing,
right?
Yeah, like, yeah he's not presiding over the trial. Like, yeah, it's not a thing.
He's like, you can have your continuance when you pry it out of my cold, dead hands. Now, we're pausing this trial for now.
Yeah, we will continue this trial at a later date. But that gives so Judge Marty's dad's appointment to the D.C. Circuit to fill Brett Kavanaugh's seat gives Dennis Quaid and Cher a time to go to do some PIing.
Well, so what's happened is Quaid picked a key off of the dead religious zealot's body that, again, he didn't tell the police. He didn't, he's doing it all himself. He just stole a key, purloined a key, and they're going to find out what it is, I guess.
And so they go to the Department of Justice archives, and this may be my favorite unintentionally hilarious scene in this movie. So they're like combing through the dark records on the 14th floor, right? And they walk past. So again, you have all the scenery is amazing, right? Like they walk past the original Mac with 128K of RAM. Yeah. And like we learn that, that Elizabeth, has been, transcribing all the records onto quote computer discs.
Dennis Quaid is like, which is, her unit was working on transcribing this stuff to computer disc.
And then, They just stop in the middle, and you hear the off-screen voices of the two guards. And the one guard is like, Bob, what are you doing on the 14th floor? Like, you're supposed to be on the 15th floor. So I'm going to check out the 14th floor. And it's like, and there's this moment of like, will they or won't they get caught by the... And then it's like, and then the guards just wander. Nope. They won't. That's
absolutely
it.
Pointless. They're like, hey, are you about to check this floor? Yeah. I already checked that floor. Go to another floor. Okay.
Yeah.
Like what?
It reminded me. There's this great bit in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy where
I thought we were in a hurry, Andrew. there's this super tense
battle over Magrathea, and everything looks like they're about to be destroyed, and then Douglas Adams just narrates in the book and is like, studies have shown that stress and nervous tension are now serious social problems in all parts of the galaxy. So in order that should not be exacerbated in any way, we will give you the following facts that will now be revealed. No one gets hurt. Nothing happens. And don't worry. Nothing to be stressed about. And that's totally what I felt like.
Yeah,
they unlock
the drawer. Yeah, for no reason. They have the guard. I don't know what that bit was. But they unlock the drawer and they find like the receipt or something. Like the files are missing. Yeah. But it says
there's a
like,
blanket. It's a blanket in the drawer with a card on it that says,
like,
Elizabeth did this in 1986.
Yeah. You've been hoodwinked by the Joker, but it also leaves a receipt of like you're missing 1968 files or somewhere. You know, it's like they get the information of what was there somehow. Like it's a case from. So they learn that they need to find a case from 1968. Like it's all going to hinge around that. Which probably had to do with farm subsidies. Oh, wait, no, that's absolutely not anything to do.
Nope. But we get this fantastic line from Cher where she looks at Dennis Quaid and with all seriousness is like, if I have to read every court transcript from 1968, I will. They're probably like 100.
Yeah.
And you're like, yeah, you think?
He's like, how many others? She's like, 100.
Yeah, there's probably 5, 6. Yeah,
I was like,
tops,
well, 1968 in just what? In just the DC federal whatever thingy?
A kind of like a little bit was going on in 1960. Right? Yeah. Like that was the height of the Vietnam War, of the protests, of everything. None of that plays, by the way.
There's like lots of like bombings and stuff. Like there's all kinds of stuff going on in 1968.
So then they're going to do law detectiving and they go to the law library. And again, this was just one of these like super nostalgic moments that like judges and lawyers used to hang out in the law library. Like there was no Lexis, right? Like you had to go look cases up in the books. And so they do that. They get another thing right. Which is, Cher has, now I don't know why she doesn't go get these herself, but Cher has Dennis Quaid bring her the FSUP reporters, right, the federal supplement, which is entirely, like, that's the book in which opinions from the District Court for the District of Columbia are in fact reported, right, and reprinted. And even better than that, she says, go get me volume 287, 287 F's Up is one of the F's Ups from 1968.
Wow.
So, like, all of it. Yeah, it's dead on. It's great. The only bad thing is she's like, she's got 286, and she's like, go get me 287, and it's like up three flights of stairs. Like, you know where 287 is in a law library? It's next to 286 F's Up.
Well, like, maybe she already grabbed, yeah, I don't know. Well, yeah. Also, they do the thing where, like, well, yeah, Marty Crane almost catches that, you know, they do a thing where Cher, like, somehow tips him off that Marty Crane is there. And so Dennis Quaid walks by her just in time, like he's going to sit down with her. But then he notices the paper, blah, blah, blah. But, like, Marty Crane would just be like, hey, what the fuck are you doing here? You're a juror. What is?
Yeah. Yeah.
Doing some law research?
This is. Yeah, juror? This is absolutely the point in which the judge, seeing a juror from one of his cases, even if he didn't want to put his thumb on the scale, which he does, would be like, would go over and say, Dennis Quaid, you can't be in the law library. Like, because one of the things that jurors can't do is you can't research the law on your own. And you can't bring your own knowledge of what the law is into the jury box.
This
right?
Was
like,
absurd.
You have to listen to the instructions that they give you. And, like, that's super important for both lawyers, right? Like, everybody knows. It's why all the cases that we talk about that are criminal cases, like, so many of them are jury instruction cases, right? Because for jury instructions to mean something, they have to be instructions, right? Like, it has to be the stuff that you must do.
But,
if jurors could just go, like, look shit up, you'd be like, well, why am I here? So, yeah, you would instantly kick this guy off the jury, right? Like, that's
but don't worry, Marty Crane, who we already have seen wants to put his thumb on the scale here, is going to sequester them because of this. Sequester the jury.
That's his. Look, like, there are alternates. Just kick him off the jury. And what's more, like, it would make no difference to this trial whatsoever.
Yeah.
Right? Like, Dennis Quaid doesn't have to be on this jury. Like,
and from Cher's perspective, let's say, okay, we're buying the fact that he's some ace detective. How about just
kick
get him off
kick
the
him
fucking
off the
jury,
and then he can work
him.
With her openly.
Yeah.
Yeah. It'd be totally fine. So I don't know why the movie doesn't do that. It doesn't. You're right. Judge Frazier's dad sequesters the jury, which is going to lead to my absolute favorite.
But I love it too. But before that, we have a scene where she's like all tired and she's like, I'm tired. I don't know, whatever. But then Dennis Quaid is going to like kiss a little sense into her. Good old 80s style. Like, quiet woman. You know, that kind of thing. Like, Once you start kissing her, then it's all fine. So that happens.
Yep.
But it's also funny that she, like, she's not really into him, though. I kind of like that. It was like, they wanted, I don't know, they couldn't decide whether he's the guy who's just, you know, attractive to everybody and she's into him or not. And they sort of lean toward not. It's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
Especially with the weirdest ending in cinema history, which we will get to.
We're going to talk about that. And I want to talk about the Roger Ebert review. I'm sure you saw the reference to that as well.
Actually.
Oh, my God. It's amazing, which we'll get to in the big reveal. But Roger Ebert wrote that, like, Cher and Dennis Quaid had genuine chemistry on the screen, at which point I can think Roger Ebert must have never known love in his entire life.
To him, love is an overworked, tired woman who has no interest in romance, and then Dennis Quaid. That's his idea.
Maybe this is a sad window into Roger Ebert's soul. He's like, that's what dating is all about, right? Like, a woman's fucking exhausted and not into you.
Couple little details that I also admired, and maybe you did, maybe you didn't. You can tell me, but like, we haven't yet mentioned the little noise machine. I love it. Every time they're at Marty Crane's bench.
That's a real thing.
Love it. It's a real thing. He like hits the little noise machine so the jury can't hear. And then also another thing I love, we get back into the, because they're still debating a continuance. I didn't really understand why they're still going with this trial, but we get back to the trial, I think. And, I like also that like nobody's in the courtroom. There's like two people.
Yeah.
I love it. Great detail.
I love it. I love it too. It's all fucked up though because Cher is going to call Liam Neeson to the stand.
I know, it's so bad. Cher's going to call the world's worst possible witness of all time ever that you would
she's
never.
She's going to call somebody
in a thousand years would do.
Yeah,
I know
point,
this.
Yeah, at every point in this movie, while cornered, including by Cher herself, has lashed out violently, yeah. And she's going to put that person on the stand. Someone who, by everyone's admission, is mentally unstable
and also,
after serving in Vietnam and incredibly violent.
And they didn't
not
even do a good job of like, okay, maybe you're going to do that and it's the worst. But then script in that you're actually accomplishing something. They didn't even do that because she just...
They don't.
She does some weird... speech
it's
at
terrible.
Him, where she like
it's terrible.
She lectures.
It's terrible. Yeah.
Liam Neeson is like, pick yourself up by your own bootstraps, you hobo. Like, what? What did that have anything to do with it?
And the thing is, we've seen throughout this movie that the writers know how to write direct.
Yeah,
right. Like they could have, but they don't. Right. So, thing I liked is that Liam Neeson is testifying via koala pad. So
true. It also sets us up for the best law joke in the history of the law, because we get to the cross-examination and Fat Tony is like going through all the time. By the way, there's more times than we even knew about that he beat people up and like, oh, you beat your superior officer. You would never put this fucking guy in the stand in 1,000 years. Yeah. But he gets to the point where he's listing all the people that Liam Neeson has like beat and murdered in his life pretty much. And then he's like, and you punched your own attorney in the face. And she goes, objection, Your Honor, that's privileged.
and the best part, the continuing punchline, because Fat Tony looks at the jury and goes, I'm withdrawn. Like,
yeah.
It's great. I'm so glad that we both picked that was
my favorite
such a fantastic.
It's so good that Lydia and I both laugh. We're like, that's a fantastic joke. Like, objection, the punch between my client and I. His privilege. Sorry. How would that really work?
You'll be violating attorney dumpster confidentiality. No. The fact that your client punched you would in fact be attorney client privilege.
That's awesome.
Like, yeah, because it is a form of communication.
I mean, assuming you didn't press charges or something, right? Like,
yeah. Right. Yeah. You could introduce. Yeah. I don't. It would be really interesting if you press charge. You would have
privilege.
Not to. Right?
My favorite law joke of all time was that. It's so great.
Oh, and then I'm riding high on this. So then we get a view of the sequester bus. That seems weird, but whatever. They're all going to get on the sequester bus. And I wrote down in my notes, quote, "Oh my God! If they Pauly Shore this movie, I will never stop laughing. It will replace Tom Cruise kicking the shit out of Wilford Brimley as my new favorite everything."
How would you define them Pauly Shoring the movie?
Put a pin in that. Well, that would be like sequestered juror sneaks out from from the sequester under the flimsiest
of pretenses.
If Dennis
Quaid throws wet paper towels on the ceiling, I thought that's because that doesn't happen.
And in fact, so we get a quick cut of Cher going over to the garage where the
Quaid in the sequester bus sees a license plate.
Yeah. Dum, dum, dum. Which will come into play. And so Cher goes over. The car's still not in the impound lot, despite being the site of a murder. She rifles through the glove box because no one's thought
she
to do that.
She breaks the window. She breaks the window, searches the car top to bottom. There's nothing there. And to which it's funny because the second time I was watching this, I was like, I didn't remember what it was. Actually, I missed it. So I was like, what is she fucking doing? And I was thinking they've already searched this fucking thing. But then, no, here's what the police didn't think to do. She hits eject on the tape deck and out comes a tape that made no sense for the woman to have had in there. But whatever.
And so we just know she's got the tape, and then we get to flash over to Sequester Hotel, where Dennis Quaid is throwing wet paper towels onto the ceiling and uses his cigarette lighter to trigger the sprinkler alarm, and then in the commotion runs out exactly like jury duty.
There is an important piece of information though that we do need to get out. We find out that a certain AG. Was involved in this 1968 case. I think his name was Red Herring. I think is his name. He was involved. Bill Barr, who fucks Red Hair, that guy. That's kind of the theory that she's going with, like, oh, that guy was involved in the thing. And we also had a scene that we kind of skipped that was like Dennis Quaid asking him about the presidential pin thing, and he makes no sense because he's like, oh, that's not mine. And then he's like, well, oh, maybe it is mine. I'll go check. I never know what the truth of that is. It actually doesn't even make any sense. Yep. So she goes to she rushes to Marty Crane's house to tell him, hey, Frasier's dad, I've found a tape. It's evidence, blah, blah, blah. And then the red herring walks in, like, as she's about to tell him. And so she's like, you know what? Maybe I better, if they're friends, you know, or whatever, like, he's around, maybe I shouldn't reveal this piece of information. And so she doesn't tell. And I just have to say, Marty Crane, when she comes in, says, okay, but this is highly irregular. And I just want to say, like, that's a judge, that's something judges have to say. Like, isn't that, that's like reason one you become a judge is, I want to say, I'll allow it, but it's highly irregular.
That's highly irregular, counsel. Yeah, no, that is one of the perquisites of being a judge. Yeah. All of this is fantastic. And there's, and I didn't even mention the, like, we have more of the, like, crazy stuff that would make sense if this movie were shot today, but in an era without cell phones, like, we have Dennis Quaid calling the district attorney's office, not sorry, the public defender's office at like 9 at night, where the receptionist not only is answering the phone but knows exactly where Cher is at all times. Trust me, public defender receptionist goes home at 4:30 in the afternoon, pal.
Yeah, I know.
but Cher has lost the book that has the case that is U.S. versus Cook in it, and she's got to run back to the courthouse. This is, and I was so delighted by this. It's the only scene that's not shot on location because it is shot at the Greenbelt Courthouse in Maryland. A courthouse in which I have practiced, in which I have litigated.
Wow, like, really?
Because,
did you ever get stabbed by anybody in it?
I did not.
Did not, okay.
That courthouse, I should say it's shot in two places because there's the courthouse and then there's, you know, shadowy figure whom we are led to believe is
going
to be Bill
Well,
Barr.
So they've been doing the hardest of hard fakes. Like the hard faking that it's A.G. Barr, you know, red herring, as hard as they can. They're doing everything. And then the minute that, as she's looking in the courthouse and a shadowy figure is at the door, and the way the door fucking frame is, like, perfectly just cuts off the middle of his body and you can see through the glass door. Right when that happened, I was like, oh, it's fucking Marty Crane, because otherwise, you know, like, you've hard faked that it's this guy. And they even made, like, the sides of his hair to look more like... Like, it's so annoying to me because it's like... the most artificial hard faking that it's the AG, but it's obviously not because they don't show his face.
And then we have the a duplicate of the incredibly uncompelling will they get discovered scene with the world's least compelling chase scene in which
a 10-minute
shadowy
walk
figure walks briskly after Cher, who takes the elevator to the basement of the courthouse, which has Alcatraz in it, like an abandoned jail for
reason. The elevator has a stop that's in a jail.
it's just like
right button.
Level 6 is the parking garage, level 4 is the gift shop, level 3 is the abandoned jail. She goes to level 3.
One level is like you push a button, the door opens, and you're in the middle of like gladiator combat or something. Like, why are you in a jail? That doesn't make sense.
Federal courthouses do not have jails in their basement, in case our listeners need to be told that. Then we just see an arm go to strangle Cher, and she takes the straight
she
razor.
She stabs in him, and all we hear is a,
slash my gaveling
arm! Damn it!
Yeah.
That's all we hear.
And by the way, like, I have shaved with a straight razor before. I don't know if you have. Like, this movie portrays them like they are laser guided vibro blades, right? Like, it is when a straight razor touches anybody in this movie, like when it touched Dennis Quaid earlier, it exploded two blood packs. And when you see the like Tom Savini level, you know, special effects put on him, Cher is like, it's a good thing you were wearing a jacket, a sweater, a coat, like two shirts, an undershirt, because otherwise, like, I mean,
it's
we
like
all
a
know.
Lightsaber, just like fizzles right through. But okay, so now we hear the tape, and the tape is a confession from Cyril Richard. It's like, well, yes, when I was a young British lad, I was worked on a case in the 60s, I believe. And so he confesses to having, like, okay, something that makes no fucking sense. He confesses to having fixed a case to that where a politician was accused of like voter fraud or something.
Right.
And question, Andrew, that doesn't fucking work because like you just appeal it to the next level of court, right? Like how get,
yeah.
Am I
well,
crazy?
Look, like, or? Look, the trial court judge absolutely can affect it, right? Because the trial court is the finder of fact. So, that would work, if, you know, there was any case in history in which, you know, voter fraud, you know, was brought down a politician from a, you know, district trial court. Like, just make it a different high stakes thing, right? Make it a Kennedy kind of thing.
Like, yeah, like, get away with it. That would have made more sense.
Yeah, that would have made lots more sense. By the way, totally crazy side note, because I, of course, paused the screen when Cher finds the decision to look at
it. I knew you would do that. I was like, should I pause this and read it? I was like, nah, Andrew will do it.
Nah, I will do it. I don't even need it. And what they've just done is they've taken a sticker that says opinion, you know, Charles F. Lowell, district judge, and stuck it over a different case. But the cool thing is that the citation, and they changed the citation too, so that it says U.S. v. Cook, right? But the intro paragraph makes no sense. It's from an entirely different case. It's and in fact, they cut off a sentence with a comma, like it's instantly clear.
Well, back
that
in the
gibberish.
Day, you couldn't have possibly frozen the screen to read it. Like the VCR would have had those big ass like lines in it and stuff.
But I think you still could have seen the comma. Who knows? I mean, it would have been pixels, so you wouldn't have. But here's this is the crazy conspiracy theory part of this movie, and I just want to share it with you. The case caption number is given as 1193-66. Okay, so it's a case brought in 1966. It actually belongs to a case called Dodd versus Pearson, which is in 279 of the federal supplement, 279 F sup 101. It's a 1968 decision. So same year. Dodd in that case is Thomas Dodd, the father of Connecticut Senator Chris Dodd, who was himself a senator from Connecticut. He was found to have stolen campaign funds and was censured by the Senate in 1967. As a result of that censure, he lost his Senate seat to the best Republican of the 20th century, Lowell Weicker. And Dodd later sued journalists Jack Anderson and Drew Pearson for what they did was Anderson and Pearson got documents that Dodd's staffers had stolen out of his office, and they published an expose and said, look, he's a corrupt piece of shit. And Dodd sued them to recover damages. The district court opinion said, you can do that. Yes, they were stolen from your office. And even if you are a corrupt piece of shit, they're your property. You can sue the journalist for damages. Wow. The Supreme Court, as you will be happy to learn, reversed that decision. So I don't know if this was meant to be like inspired by that. Like this was a subtle swipe at Thomas Dodd. But the spoiler, the closing credits have a really lengthy disclaimer, right? In which they say this
the
is not based on actual events.
The first thing you see after the weirdest ending in cinema history is, no, this is not real. It was just a coincidence.
And it says, right, no similarity with any person living or dead is intended, comma, or should be inferred. Right. Which is right. Like that's an extra layer of disclaimer. That's the kind of thing that I write for Eli. So I don't know if this was meant to be a veiled dig at Thomas Dodd.
Well,
nobody else seems to
have a more
out, but,
fictional conspiracy theory about this thing. So but I need you to fucking tell me what happens at the end of this movie, because not the super the actual end, the bizarre end I keep teasing, but the. Not that part, the courtroom end, because here we've got, you know, someone's been stabbed, you know, in their gaveling arm, and we cut to court the next day or whatever. And who would it be but Red Herring himself, Paul Gray, the Attorney General Bill Barr character, storms into the court and says, I've been subpoenaed. And then Marty Crane's like, what? I haven't heard of any subpoenas. He's like, yeah, I'm here on the. He says, I've come on advice of counsel. On my own volition to hear charges?
The only thing I could think of is it's the, like boggle words just like on the pop-o-matic bubble and they were running out of time to write the script because none of that, all of that is nonsense, right?
But like, also, what is it even from Cher's perspective? So does Cher know it was Marty Crane yet or not?
I think we are meant to think that she does, and she's brought Bill Barr in because she thinks the Attorney General is the person that brings charges. You know, because he's the head of the Justice Department. But he's only the Assistant Attorney General. I don't know.
But
it's all.
But he's been subpoenaed, though. That doesn't make sense.
It doesn't. It makes no sense whatsoever.
And so, as she's arguing with him, Marty Crane is like, "What the hell?" She's like, "I have another witness." He's like, "Okay, fine. Call that witness because this didn't make any sense." I call your honor to the stand. What?
Yeah.
And then, so.
This is the greatest bad law. We've whipsawed so much.
Okay. I have several theories about this, and I'm sorry we're so over time, but this is the crux of the movie. One theory is, did she want to get his gaveling arm working so hard that his bandage would wear off? I'm not even joking. Like, I genuinely am confused.
Yeah. That never occurred to me, but it certainly is within the realm of possibility.
It's in the top two plausible things.
Oh, God. So here's what actually happens, right? What actually happens is we get the head fake of Red Herring. I wish I'd called him Red Herring in my notes. That's, that's an even better name than Bill Barr. So Red Herring has been subpoenaed to serve as a witness. Ignore the other stuff. The judge is like, all right, fine, whatever. And she's like, I have yet another surprise witness, each more surprising than the last. I call your honor to the stand. And he's like, No.
Yeah.
I'm not a witness. No, that's crazy. And so then Cher out Matlock's Matlock, right? She just pretends that she's called him to the stand and starts asking her questions in the Matlock, like, I'm going to break you down. And the moment, and like all of this, I was just taking notes and sort of like chortling to myself. But then I had the legitimate laugh out loud moment.
Yeah.
Because as we've pointed out, Liam Neeson has this IBM PC Junior setup with its, you know, that is that the court transcriptionist is, you know, because he's deaf. Right. And all of a sudden you see him stand up and you realize that the transcriptionist has been transcribing this fucking nonsense.
Yeah, yeah.
That's why
they wanted him to factor in somehow in the end. So I think that the Marty Crane's like, bailiff, seize her kind of thing, you know. And he's reading all this in fast enough time to get up. He's in handcuffs because he killed several people in this. He's the worst. Like, there's no reason for him to be that bad. But anyway, he's in handcuffs. He gets up and he like tackles with his body the bailiff to like keep her talking, I guess. It doesn't even make any sense.
I don't get it. It's
and so
just...
he's gaveled so much that he starts bleeding.
That he starts bleeding.
And here's the thing. Here's my second theory. So that's first theory. I have a second theory this would be one of those fan theories. Like, if this was a current movie, I would put this in a forum. But, you know, I do like a post where I'm like, here's the fan theory of what really happened. Because this whole time, Marty Crane, and I like this part, Marty Crane is cool as a cucumber this entire thing. Like, he's, which I kind of, you know, I don't mind that. Like, he plays it cool. He's a judge. He's got his shit together. He plays it cool this whole time. Up until... And through the point where he sees blood coming down his own gaveling arm, he's still playing it cool. And a part of me is like, you know what? What if he doesn't even know he's the bad guy? Like, they didn't even tell the actor that he's the bad guy. Like, I'm genuinely, like, that, like he
How
doesn't.
How great would that be if he's just been reading through the script? He's like, oh, wait a minute. Wait, I'm the bad guy?
I was going to say choose your own adventure or something. It's like one of those things. They bring both the guys who are going to be the bad guy into the same setting. They've set them both up to where they're both, like, called to the stand. And then I think the TV turns to you and goes, which one do you think is the bad guy? And like, there's two different endings depending on what you choose.
If you'd like Frasier's dad to be the killer, turn to page 34.
Call in and vote or something. Yeah. Or here's my other super conspiracy theory. What if the blood has been planted on his arm and he literally wasn't the guy, but somebody framed him up? Because it doesn't make any sense.
That'd be great.
And so, did they even get him? Because none of this is admissible anything.
Right. Yeah. No, I guess you're supposed to think. So Cher says, which you can't do, she has filed charges with the police department. public defenders don't get to do that, right? Like,
yeah.
She'd go talk to a cop and say, I think there's a judge who tried to, you know, kill me last night, but that's just being a witness, you know, being a crime victim. And I think you're supposed to think, well, Bill Barr, you know, red herring saw all this, so, you know, now you're going down. I don't know. I love, this is where I bring in the Roger Ebert review. Who he gave this movie 2.5 stars. And after talking about the fantastic chemistry between Cher and Dennis Quaid, writes that the ending is, quote, as if an Agatha Christie novel evaluated 6 suspects in a British country house. And in the last chapter, we discover the killer was a guy next door, which I thought was exactly right. Like, it was just, it's not that there weren't clues that Fraser's dad was a bad guy. It's just, it made no sense for him to be the killer.
They arbitrarily made the other red herring to be the guy so fucking hard that it makes no sense. And the stabby Christian guy, like, what was his deal? So. Because I was trying to figure out, like, was he hired?
What's my motivation here? Oh, I get it. I'm violent hobo number 2.
Yeah, okay, who also slashes throats in the same exact way. But like, what, I thought it was going to be like he was hired to kill her, and then, but then Marty Crane would have just shot him or something. Like Marty, are we to imagine that Marty Crane snuck into the Christian killer's tent and slashed his throat? Like, is that what we're supposed to believe?
Yeah, yeah. Teeny 58-year-old Fraser Crane's dad.
Yeah, he's 5'8", by the way.
It was 5'8", and like Liam Neeson is 165 pounds, but that's because he's 6'4". No, he's not.
You're wrong about Liam Neeson. He's like 6'. Right. He's tall. He's a big guy.
He's tall, but he's tall
he's
and
wiry.
Skinny.
He's wiry, as they say. Yeah.
But Fraser's dad is like a 32 tiny. Waist, right? Yeah, yeah, he's 5'8".
Literally, he was on his Wikipedia because I was looking at him. He's 5'8". He's probably a buck 20. Like, he's and we're to believe that he slashed the throat of the insane Christian guy who already, like, stabbed a detective's eyes out. By the way, a detective who was an officer, like a big built guy. He like, what? It's so fucking stupid. And then the final thing that I was gonna say is, was the AG bad? Like, I'm actually not sure.
No, I think we're just led to believe that, like, the AG, like, because lots of people are sort of morally ambiguous in this, right? So I think it's just the AG is just a womanizer, right? And, like, Elizabeth was on his staff. That's his connection to this. And, you know, maybe he was banging her because he seems
like
he's
banging all
the girls.
Well, but he also was on the case or whatever. Like, he was part of the 68 case.
Oh, well, that's true. Yeah. Because
they red herringed him all the way. He was like every possible thing.
Yeah.
So was he also, but like, I wasn't sure if it was a conspiracy. Because they go out of their way to say, wow, in order to fix a case, you'd need a judge, a prosecutor, a priest,
a young priest, an old priest. Yeah.
So I don't know. Like, I genuinely don't know. But we're going
wrong. He
was
the prosecutor. So canonically in the movie, he was in on it. So why would he arrest? It makes no fucking sense.
But we have to get to the weirdest ending in cinema history, which is weeks later or something, I guess. I don't know. And Cher is like, again, being Cher, like, busy. I got another case. I'm the overworked prosecutor. And Dennis Quaid comes in. He's like, I got nothing to do. What can we do for an hour? And they like laughing, and he shuts the door. She's like, keep it open, still laughing. And then I had the subtitles on. You can't really totally make it out. She's laughing and he's like, oh, keep it open. And then she says, creep. Not even joking. She laughingly says creep. Like, I don't know. Were they involved? I actually don't know.
No, I interpreted that as him James Bonding it at the end, right? He's like, hey, what are we going to do for an hour? Like, I'm going to bang the shit out of you.
But what
right
I
now.
Love about this movie is there's actually another interpretation where he's just pretty much sexually harassing her the entire thing.
Yeah.
Like, watch the movie and tell me that's not what it is.
I will. I'll at least go watch those 5 minutes again. My note, did you notice this? Like, because I've watched this movie 2.5 times. And this scene 3 times, it took until the 3rd time for me to realize it's the same office that Cher's in before, but it's shot from such a completely different camera angle that it looks like an entirely different office.
Oh, yeah,
right?
I didn't care. I was too weirded out by the rapey stuff happening.
And the door shuts, and it's just... It's
over. And then instantly it's... I definitely didn't rip this off from any real characters. So, yeah, that's right away. It shuts over. Weirdest thing. This is one of the weirdest movies I've ever seen. There's so many ups and downs. Great stuff. But like I'm saying, if you don't count the bad stuff, so much good law. So much good law.
Yep. Yep. Here's my super quick thing. Like, and again, you gotta fix a bunch of the things that we talked about.
Yeah,
like
get rid of Dennis Quaid.
Here's what I would do with Dennis Quaid, right? Like he's not on the jury. Yeah, like stupid. That's stupid. He doesn't have to be on the jury. Like what you make it is you make Cher's like estranged uncle, right? A congressman, right? He's like, he's the key vote on the farm bill. And Dennis Quaid, like the whole movie is like doing favors for Cher, who's like, who says, you know, early on, she's like, I haven't talked to my father since, you know, we had a debate on death penalty when I was 14, right? Like, okay. It builds her character. She's like, he's liberal. He's, you know, she's liberal. He's conservative. Yeah, he's like trying to lobby Cher by doing all these favors. But she's like, you can do as many favors as you want. Like, I don't ever talk to my dad. Yeah. Right? Like, and then
you find out he was the politician that was.
There you go.
Yeah. Is it too much to ask for the bill to factor in some fucking way? Like maybe here's a simple way. The dad votes for the bill, but it's totally out of character and against what he should be doing. But he's only doing it because he thinks they're kind of onto him and he's trying to like throw them off or something. You know, like there's got to be something because the bill is stupid. There's no point to it. There's absolutely no point to it.
Why not have there be, and I haven't thought about what this would be, but there's some piece of hard evidence. And like the bill that they're lobbying for is, and again,
it's like the Restore Our Parks bill. We're going cement over the field of dead bodies or something.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so the whole movie, right? Dennis Quaid is lobbying. He's like, I don't understand. Like, this is going to build the largest outdoor green space.
And the estranged father is like against it. And then he's all of a sudden he's for it. Why is he for it?
Yeah.
That doesn't make any sense. We're geniuses, Andrew Torres. Great job. I'm gonna credit you for 82% of that, but I helped a little bit. That's a great, good job. When are we going to get in the business of making these fucking things? Come on. Somebody come at us. Jeez,
I agree. That was fun.
Good job, Andrew. Yep. I really enjoyed making the better movie on that one. I mean, I always do, but that was great. Good stuff.
Any last minute thoughts on this, Thomas?
This was so fun. I mean, I know we went long, but I was just so excited. This was a fun one. I really loved it. How about you?
I told you, like, so on the list of like, pure enjoyment. Like I think, other than The Running Man, but like this, I think I've enjoyed this movie more than any other Law and Awful movie. So much of it was so entertaining, and like the stuff that was wrong was so hilariously wrong. Like I don't know. Like if I had just gone to see this in the theaters, maybe the stuff that was wrong would have overwhelmed me. But like I was kind of glad for it. Like in the first 20 minutes, I was like, oh damn, what if this movie is just really good all the way through and I've got nothing to say? Like, yeah. But fortunately, there was bonkers stuff that we could say about.
That was a ton of fun. I agree with everything you said. This is one of the most enjoyable. I think if you subtract the bad parts of the law, you almost get back to zero, but not quite. Maybe like a, you know, plus 10 units of law. But it was fun. Thank you, patrons, for pledging and making this happen. We hope you enjoy it. This like two episodes worth of a lot of awful movies. But this was a lot of fun. And let's make a better movie. We can do it. But we also, but Cher's still in it though. We'll get her. We'll get her back.
God, yes.
Gotta be. Yeah.
I would have Cher in it now.
Yeah.
Right. And maybe, look, we did a John Cusack movie last month and John Cusack follows us on Twitter now. Ooh. So maybe Cher will start following
us on
Twitter.
And unlike John Cusack, I have nothing but good things to say about Cher, so I won't feel awkward like, oh, what if she were to hear it, you know, because I love Cher. She's great. If she was great in it, I love her.
And I love John Cusack, but, you know, and I love Cher, too. We did not even go down the rabbit trail of like what's the best Cher video. There's only one.
I couldn't name one. No. So that's again. No. I have less reason to like Cher of any person. I don't know any of her stuff. Right. I don't know. I know. Do you believe in love after love? Like that's all I got. But she was already like 60 when she did.
Yeah, yeah. No, she was 100 when she did. Yeah. I think that's the first auto-tune song, isn't it?
Anyway, I don't know. Anyway, but we got to get out of here. Thank you.
We
got to
go.
We'll see you in a month for Lamb or any other thing you hear us doing. We love you, and we'll see you soon.
Bye.